lead them down the garden path.
I plead guilty in that.
Well, Scott was supposed to go to some clubs and see the band.
Oh, what band?
Smegma.
Oh, what? He's still doing band stuff, or?
Well, he was a few years ago. We haven't seen anything lately, but it's right in Portland.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So, Scott, you haven't done that yet.
No, I haven't done that. I'm not likely to, Bob.
Come on. I put out all this energy, and you guys don't do fuck all. You either freak out halfway through it. I mean,
we're slackers, Bob.
You what?
We're slackers.
You guys are CIA just trying to see how long I can go with this. Wall.
That's right.
Oh, man.
I got a chip in my brain, and everything gets broadcasted to headquarters, everything we talk about, Bob.
Yeah. Oh, that's only you knew, Scott. Only you knew. Okay, so what? Okay, anybody got any gossip?
Not really. You haven't done a Ben show in a while, have you?
Well, last week we started to do. See, if you notice the number 36 or so, the last one that's up, Ben says,
yeah.
That's it, I'm not going to be ponderous anymore. Did you notice that note?
No.
He says, yeah, in his last, he says, no more ponderosity. He said he's getting tired of himself sounding ponderous, or pompous or ponderous, so he said, I'm not going to do it anymore. He says, this is the last show where I'll be ponderous. From now on, it's fun or something. Okay, so we start doing the show. We get, I don't know, 10 minutes into it, and we didn't get anywhere. Ben very quickly pointed out that a few nights ago, before last Wednesday, he suddenly heard or thought of something I'd said, and he said it was the stupidest thing he'd ever heard, and he couldn't sleep. He couldn't sleep, and I guess then he was talking to Esther, and Esther was saying, well, what kind of education has Bob got? And Ben says, well, he might have majored in English because he knows about I.A. Richards. So they're trying to figure out how come I'm so stupid or something, or what education am I missing? So he tells me this. I say, Ben, you tell Esther, first of all, I never went to university. I didn't major in that. I didn't even go. And then I said, all I did was hang out with geniuses, Ben. That's what I did. And then I said, Ben, in 1993, when he was at Jerry's or near Jerry's doing the interview with Zappa, just before Zappa died for his book, Jerry gave him Entertainment Sucks, the long thing that Jerry and I did. And Jerry showed me the note later where he said, well, this Bob Dobbs guy is obviously an autodidact. That means a self-taught person.
Right.
Okay, so I'm saying to Ben, now Ben, remember after I said I never went to university, just hung out with geniuses, I said, remember when you said I was an autodidact back in 93? He probably doesn't even remember. I said, well, anyways, you did, because I remember it. Well, that's what I am, Ben. I'm an autodidact who actually got that way hanging out with geniuses maybe or something. And because I don't want to say I'm just an autodidact where I just live my own head, because I listened to the geniuses. So
right.
So he said, okay, and that was that. So then we started doing our tape, and he started off being ponderous and all that, but I didn't say anything. And then he started to get pissed off, and he said, you know, Bob, I'm really tired. I don't have enough sleep. I said, yeah, Ben, we better stop. If you're fucked up the first 5 minutes, we're not going to make 50 minutes, 55 minutes. So let's just cancel for this week. It's okay. And he said, okay. So then we finished taping, or stopping the tape, and then we got talking, and then he got madder and madder. And he says, you know, well, we're just saying goodbye. Okay, we'll talk next week. And he says, yeah, you're not good enough, Bob. So then I hung up, and he hung up with that, and I hung up. So I haven't heard from him since, so I don't know what's going to happen.
It's in his nature to toss off a challenge here and there just because he likes to be provocative.
Yeah.
But let me say something for Scott's consumption. You can butt out of this for a second, Bob, unless you have something to say. And that was that mean, this is just an example of how I know Bob has operated in the past, which is that I don't remember a year or so ago I got some kind of itch to find out a little more about Charles Bukowski. Bob and I talked about it and traded. There was a movie that I'd seen, or we discussed it. And then I found out, Bob knew Charles Bukowski. You know, just another facet, you know, thing that you casually find out about Bob the more you find out about him, you know, and how he asked, well, how did you get to know Bukowski? And Bob just went to the guy's fucking house, you know, and with Bob's charisma or whatever, they struck up a conversation and Charles invites him in, and then they get to be kind of buddies. I mean, can you believe that kind of shit? And Bob just does stuff like that, and he has no sense of trepidation or resistance about finding the people that he wants to know and getting to know them. Now, would you agree with all that, Bob?
Yeah, the how that happened, I didn't know. I think I knew Bukowski because Flaps. He was in university, and he raved on about Notes of a Dirty Old Man and how great it was. And that was in the early 70s. And I looked at it, but I didn't read it much, but I said, this is probably good. But I didn't have time to read, really. So so I'm in New York in June, July 76. And you can look it up. There was a Rolling Stone article on Bukowski. And, sorry, I got that wrong. So this guy shows me this book. And then around that time, I used to go to the Nova Scotia Art College, and they would get American Underground Papers, and they had the L.A. Free Press. So I've been reading it, and then I noticed, oh, Bukowski writes a column for this paper. So I read it religiously every week, and it was hilarious. It was really good. And so that's how I knew about him. And then, let's see, I saw him at a poetry reading in New York, but, okay. So then he gives a poetry reading in 76. This is right around the time my father dies, and I didn't talk to him much right then, but I think I had my plan, because you can go back, and in the spring of 76, or May, June, July, they had an article on Bukowski in Rolling Stone, and it described approximately where he lived in L.A., and he lived in the kind of a ghetto, and I figured out, so then he did a poetry reading, and I didn't introduce myself to him there. There were too many people, and he didn't want to talk to anybody after the poetry reading because he was very antisocial, and he just went off with his girlfriend. So I waited till I got to L.A. a month later, and I got Worcester and them to drive Carol and I over to, we found a place, and it was a neat little place. The reason you could know it was eight little one-room bungalows. You know those kind of places in L.A., Scott?
Yeah.
You know, like,
well, I saw his place in the documentary they did about him. They filmed it at his place where you apparently went to meet him.
Yeah, that's the place in 76. He moved out of there by 1980. Do you know who we're talking about, Scott?
Oh, yeah.
You know, Bukowski's pretty important in a way. So,
Bangs always said he was better than him, but anyway, go on.
What did you say?
Lester Bangs always said he was better than Bukowski, but anyway, go on.
Yeah, but he had to compare himself to Bukowski.
Sure, I mean, sure,
he was the standard for the middle 70s. And so he, I remember being amazed. He went to this place, and his address was 2628 and 3/8 or something. There was eight little one-room bungalows, and he was the third one on the right, or maybe the second or first, whatever. I'd never seen those kind of addresses. And so I just knocked on the door. And it was dark, it was nighttime, and he opened the door, and he had this big head, way bigger than it seemed when he was in New York. But he had his long hair, lion's mane, and pockmarked face. He looks at me, and he says, yes. And I said, you want a party? He says, you know I don't party. I said, yeah, that's, you won't party when I party with you. So come on in. And so I talked to him for about 20 minutes because Worcester and Carol, everybody's waiting outside. And then I came back later. And then I went back to, where was that? Went back to Nova Scotia. Then we went to Toronto. And I had his phone number, and then 78, 79, I would call him often and talk to him. And then I went there in 1980, and I went up to the little bungalow, and no one answered, and somebody at the end of the courtyard in an apartment over the bigger thing at the back, and he was in the balcony, and he goes, "You looking for Buck or Henry?" I don't know what he said. I said, "Yeah," and he says, "Well, he's not here right now. Come on over." So I went over, and he introduced himself as Sam. I said, "Oh, you're Sam. You're the guy that every time I'm talking to Bukowski, Bukowski's always going, 'Just a minute, Sam, I'm on the phone.'" So he said, "You're Sam, the guy that Bukowski's always referred to." Yeah. So we had a real long talk, and I actually had a more intellectual talk with him than Bukowski, because this guy, I don't know what he was, but he was interested in McLuhan and very interested in what I knew about him, and so we had a really good discussion. You never could talk about that with Bukowski. He just talked about all the women he was fucking all the time. And so there was no ideological talk, idea talk with Bukowski. But it was he was very funny at it.
Yeah, so here's a guy who has a reputation for being antisocial, and
yeah.
Bob, it doesn't even take nerve on Bob's part. I don't know, Bob, you know, it would take nerve for anybody, but Bob just goes, meets him, and he invites him in.
Yeah, well, I know what to say. I mean, I did it with Chris Story over in London in April 2008. He says, "How come you didn't make an appointment?" I said, "I don't make appointments." He says, "Okay, come in." Yes, and I don't even know I'm going to say that. Like I say, "You want a party?" Because he says, "I don't party." Like, he says, "You know," as if I know, but I did know. "You know I don't party." And I says, "Yeah, but you don't party when you party with me." He says, "Okay."
I thought he was a serious alcoholic, and he did party. What did that mean?
Oh, he did. That's the point. He would. That's a good question.
He was being ironic.
No, he doesn't party with strangers.
Oh.
You know, somebody knocking the door, "You want to party?" He's not going to, "Who am I? You know, I could kill him or something."
Right.
So, but he partied seriously with his friends.
Yeah.
You know, with Sam and that. And I often caught him on the phone when he was drunk.
Yeah.
But he was sober. He could talk and think while he was, or at least keep discursing on his topics, his girlfriends while he was drunk. You know.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's the way it's always, that's what I did. I said, "Well, this is an interesting guy, let's go over and talk to him, Carol."
Now, Bob, you didn't, but see, the thing that's curious about you, Bob, is that, see, if I had this fantasy about meeting him and then I met him and all he wanted to talk about was fucking his girlfriends, I'd probably lose interest pretty fast. But you're fascinated with everything that goes on around you all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, I ask him questions. That's what Greg Skinner learned from me. He says, this is a guy in Nova Scotia, he says, "You know, Bob, you can engage the most banal conversations and actually get something out of them." and that's what McLuhan said. Even if he goes to a bad movie, he can see patterns. You see, like, it's... And the thing with... What was I going to say about... Because, oh, yeah. The other thing is, Scott, I don't believe anything the media says about these people. And that's the first thing, you know. I don't care. I just read a few quotes by the guy and say, "Oh, that's interesting stuff. Okay, I'll go meet him." I don't care what the interviewer or the journalist says about him. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. You don't believe the media.
It's funny, Bob, because I think in these chats, you've now revealed that you've had contact with almost every single person we've discussed, except for Meltzer, actually.
Yeah.
Like you know, sometimes I was wondering if you're actually pulling my leg a little bit, like about calling Bangs up on the phone at Cream and stuff. Like,
no,
like
I did do that.
Eh?
Yeah, I don't.
I believe it. I mean, I think Cream was kind of, you know, place that people would just kind of do that sort of stuff. So
yeah, I'm not a very good liar. I don't know how to lie.
I'm not saying
except about your age, Bob. There's, you know,
that's for you to believe. You know, this, I don't lie about my age, but the thing is, I like having energy in what I interact with. And you know, if you start lying and double thinking about what you're going to say, that's no fun. It blocks your thoughts to get distracted.
Yeah.
And you got
yeah.
no flow. Finally flow. And it's no point in me saying I called him up. Who gives a fuck? But I did call him up, and it was fun to do it. And I have interesting stories for those that met him or like him or interested.
No, it's cool. I mean, you had that contact with him. You had the... encounter with Marcus when you said you got up at one of his talks or something and questioned him on Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
I think you said you did a Christgau thing or something.
Yeah, that was at the DIA conference.
The DIA conference, and
I even pulled a joke at Andy Warhol.
Really, eh?
Yeah. In 1975, I called up the factory, and I said, "This is Marsh McLuhan." I didn't try to sound like Marsh McLuhan or anything. I said, "This is Marsh McLuhan. I'm in town. Wonder if Andy's available." I kind of knew they were in touch, so they put me through. You say the right name, they put me through to Andy, and he goes, "This stupid voice, hey, hello. Andy, this is Marshall. I'm in town for another 24 hours. Wonder if I could drop over to the factory, say the next hour?" He said, "Well, I guess so, Marshall. Yeah, come on over." So something happened. I think I didn't. I suddenly remembered, oh, he's fucking moved. I don't know where the new place is. Something like that. So I called back about half an hour later and said, I have a problem. I couldn't find a place or something. And I should say this. So Andy, the guy, when I first called, he says, "Why do you want to talk to Andy?" I said, "Well, you know, I study media trends, and I want to see what's happening in the figure of New York and apply my ground analysis to that." So I used the McLuhan language. The guy didn't even know what it meant, probably. So he said, "Okay," and he put me through. So I fuck up, and I have to call him back half an hour later. And this time the guy said, "We don't believe you're Marshall McLuhan." Andy came out and he said, "Do you think that guy was Andy McLuhan? Was Marshall?" And the guy says, "I don't know, Andy." And Andy says, "I don't know." And he said that they thought about it for a while and decided they were going to let me in when I got there. So that was even good for me. I didn't waste time going down, but they decided I wasn't Marshall. And it wasn't hard. I mean, I didn't sound like him. I made my word. I made the idea content sound like him, but not the tone of voice. I'm not a very good imitator of voices, but I can make the content sound like McLuhan. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I've done that all over the fucking place.
That's funny. And you said you had the encounter with Patti Smith.
Oh yeah, several with her. I mean, Gerard Malanga, I haven't met Ozzy Osbourne or whatever his name is. I haven't met him. Didn't meet
Brian. What about Dylan?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm the one who explained the meaning of the story at the end of, or the back, on the back of John Wesley Harding. You ever read the story on the back of that?
I think so.
It's about Zappa. And as a matter of fact, in 93... or 95, they had in L.A., some radio station had a big celebration of Dylan, and some musician, he wasn't a major musician, but he was a fan of Dylan, he was the DJ host. Jerry found out about this, and you know, we might have this on tape. I don't think it's on, I wonder if it's on the time. Anyways, Jerry found out about it, so we heard, tuned in, and Jerry got me to call in, and I told the story of being at the studio in New York in 67 when Dylan was finishing up John Wesley Harding, and how we got talking about Zappa, and he was wondering about Zappa, who was performing at Garrick Theater that summer, and thinking about Zappa. I mean, when you're a leading-edge artist, you're thinking about whatever's happening. What's strong and important, you have to deal with. You know what I mean? So Zappa was the big thing that summer, so he was thinking about it. So as a result of our conversation, he wrote that story. And so I explained this to this guy, the DJ, in the audience, and words that everybody was listening. And that's on record, which I'm sure we have that on tape. Jerry taped it.
Huh.
So that's Dylan.
Wow.
Now, Bob, I know in your history there, you claim to have met Zappa and Beefheart when they were teenagers out in
1958.
On the desert. Where was that? Ontario or something like that there?
Lancaster.
Lancaster, yeah. Now, frankly, I have my doubts about that. There's no way to verify any of that information, and it's pretty far out. But nevertheless, when you got to know Zappa again later in life, I think I heard a story that you just sort of like, well, when he moved to that place on Mulholland Drive,
that
one day you just sort of showed up and hung around his in his driveway or something like that?
That's in March 1970.
Yeah. Oh, actually, no, we went and visited that house, remember, when I was in L.A.? Yeah, that place. So you just kind of showed up and hung around his driveway or something?
First off, you read the diary notices. It goes, I see him in 58 and then 60, 61. I recommend Cucamonga Studio to him because I had run across Paul Buff. And he says, oh, I'll do that. And then you'll find out later he already knew, but he didn't tell me. But I thought I had heard about it, so I told him. So he goes over there. And you track through the various, every few years I'm with Zappa. And in 1970, March 1970, we're with Dave Wurster and everybody in Seattle, the Cosmic Warriors gang, and they go down to see Krishnamurti speak in L.A. So Carol and I went down with them. And everybody stayed at this hotel. I think I still see it there on the beach, Santa Monica or Venice Beach, this hotel, old hotel. Everybody stayed there, and we got a room there. But everybody was running around doing their things. They went over to see Jodun Sloan. Some of them even stayed with Jodun Sloan and the D-Cell guy. But Carol and I decided I hadn't seen Frank since 67 or 68, something like that. So several years, he had moved. I didn't know he had moved. But I knew where the log cabin was because I'd been there, the famous log cabin. Have you seen those articles on how the CIA created Laurel Canyon and all that? And
Zappa? No.
Have you seen those articles?
I haven't.
Okay. So anyways, there's even a book about Laurel Canyon. So Zappa's famous, it was called the log cabin because it was Tom Mix, the famous cowboy western star of the 20s. Tom Mix's old cabin and Houdini was nearby and there were tunnels between the houses. That house on Laurel Canyon Drive going up the hill, or is it Laurel Canyon Boulevard, right? You go winding up.
Yeah, I know it. I know the street.
So right on the corner, okay, on the halfway up and near the store, the famous store where all the groupies and everybody hung out with, it's like the scene in the beginning of the Doors movie, even though that's more on Venice Beach, but there might be a section where they're up in Laurel Canyon in the movie. So Zappa was king of Laurel Canyon at the log cabin. And so I knew I had been there, and so we went up there, knocked on the door. This beautiful woman comes, and I say, "Is Frank in?" I know he's married to Gail, but and this woman kind of looks like Gail, as pretty as Gail, but different. And I'm not sure what's going on. So I say, "Is Frank in?" She goes, "Oh, Frank, no, he lives up on Woodrow Wilson Drive." And I says, "Oh, he moved." And she, yeah. So we walked up. We had our cab had gone because we thought we'd be staying, going in that house. The cab had gone, so we walk all the way up Laurel Canyon Boulevard, find Woodrow Wilson, which I didn't even know what it was, but it's right at the top of the hill. You turn right and you wind along, and I have no idea which house it is, so I'm just going along, just feeling it out. And we eventually, and this is like 4:30 in the afternoon, and eventually we come sort of near the end, and this little boy comes around, and he starts talking to us. You know, we're friendly people. Little kids will talk to us. And he's saying, "Oh, I love this way, this place. Why? Oh, there's all these musicians." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, there's Mama Cass lives up there," and named someone else. And then I said, "Well, where's, you ever heard of Frank Zappa?" "Yeah, he lives right there." We were standing right in front of his Zappa's house. So that's how I found out. And that is in 1970. And you can look in, any archives has photos, but the picture is in Time magazine. The last week of October 69, Zappa is interviewed because he's broken up the mothers and he's talking about his Uncle Meat movie, and it's a picture of him and Gail standing on the walkway up to the house. This is before the fence was around it and before it was built up. And it was so that I can show you that those steps. Carol and I sat there. No one was around. Now listen to this. We're sitting there, 4:30, 5:30, around 6 o'clock, it turned out the little cottage in the back starts playing a single is played, and it's then played again, and then it's played again. It's like, you know, 3 minutes or something. It just keeps getting repeated and repeated and repeated, and we ignore that, and it goes on for an hour, and nobody's around, and then the GTOs come by, which I don't think I would have known they were the groupies, the GTOs at that point. So these two girls come by, and they're all dressed in their costumes and everything. And Carol and I say, they say, hi, what are you doing? We're waiting for Frank. Oh, Frank, he should be home soon. Is Gail here? No, we got to go in and look after the kids. So they say, we'd like to invite you in, but I don't know if we can. So we said, that's all right. So they go in, and they play in 1969. You would have had Dweezil was born in the fall of 69, so he would only be like 4 months old or something, and Moon Unit was about 2 years old. She was born September. Oh, they were both born in September because Dweezil was born on the day of Polarity, September 5th, 69. That's the little thing, you know, that whole thing with Worcester, Scott, the apex of Polarity that's in the Worcester interview?
Hey, I kind of forgot that.
Yeah, September 69. That's the day that Dweezil was born. And she was born September 28th, 29th, or something, 67. So the record keeps playing, and it eventually stops. I find out later that it's... who's the drummer for Zappa right at that point, after the Mothers? A very good drummer. British guy?
Not Ainsley Dunbar.
Ainsley Dunbar. Oh. Ainsley Dunbar. Somehow we find out Ainsley Dunbar is up there, and I think he was playing the record over and over again to drive us away. He wanted to see if we could take the Zen music torture, you know? Because why would it go on forever and ever and ever? And it's not like it was stuck, you know? I think he was trying to do a... He was probably trying to do the Zappa ideology of annoying people. So we just ignored it, and that was that. So then Zappa, it gets dark, and we're sitting there for 3 or 4 hours, but this is what we do. We're just enjoying it. We got nowhere to go. And so this guy walks up, and he's like short hair. He's like in the military, or I just get this military straight thing. And I say, hi. He says, what are you doing? I said, we're waiting for Frank. And he goes, oh, Frank, what a great guy. I've known him since I was a kid. So I got a feeling this was a boyhood friend of Frank or something. So he says again, you know, Frank is just an amazing guy, and I hope you meet him. He didn't know we already even met him, but he just said, I hope you meet him. So, okay, yeah, we hope to meet him too. So he goes in. Then eventually a car drives up, and Gail gets out of it, and Frank gets out of the passenger seat, and he walks up. And he does his amazing loping walk. It's a very strange walk. He's like bent down and loping forward. And Gail comes up and looks at us and frowns. She was always antisocial and paranoid. And Frank stands up and he looks at me. And I don't think he recognizes me. And I said, Frank. He says, why are you here? And I said, well, we need to talk. And he says, well, I got a business meeting. And then I said, okay, Frank, you have this recurring theme in your albums. And I bring up a conceptual continuity point, and it wasn't called that. Nobody knew that yet, but I bring it up. He goes, Bob! My question made him remember me. You know what I mean? He goes, Bob! And I says, yeah. He says, are you here? And I says, yeah, we're here for another week. And he said, well, I can't. I got to do an important business meeting now, so come back later. And so we said, okay. So we went back later, a week later. Well, he did a concert. You can get on the bootlegs at the Olympic Auditorium on March 7th. And that's where we saw his new Hot Rats band. And then I saw him after the concert. So the point I was, okay, so that's March 70. In the summer of 71, he has a problem with Warner Brothers. Finds out later Herbie Cohen, his manager, is ripping him off. And so he writes this thing, and you can find it on the web. Hey, snazzy executive of Warner Brothers, why don't you promote our albums? It's a complaining thing, but it's funny. And he lays out this whole conceptual continuity theme, which he had never talked about before. But I secretly felt that because I brought it up or started to think that way, because there were enough albums out to sort of notice the recurring themes, recurring motifs. That he knew, and that's how you do it. You figure, oh, your audience is onto it? Okay, I'll start talking about it. Or, you know, the leading edge of your audience. So he talked about it within a few months. Well, within a year, brought out the whole idea of conceptual continuity, which became a big thing, a big obsessive thing for Zappa fans. So that's that story. See, I can go into any one of these people and go on for hours about all these.
Well, how come when you did the interview with him,
Bob Marshall did.
Bob, I actually heard the audio. That's not Bob Marshall.
Okay, don't worry about it.
Anyway, so Bob Marshall doesn't have a thing going on with Carolyn as though she's his wife.
What?
Because the guy who was interviewing Frank was making references to Carolyn on the side, and Frank was
well,
too.
Well, he grew up with Carolyn. Remember, you've heard the...
Okay, okay. Well, anyway.
As a kid.
Anyway, okay. I know I got you on this one, Bob, because I can tell the difference between you and Eddie.
I told you. Anybody can see that Ed sounds like me, but they don't understand why he sounds like me.
Yeah.
That's what they don't want to hear about.
Okay, putting that aside for an issue, we'll just suspend judgment on that. Why did you have to go through, when you did the interview with him, why did you guys have to go through Frank's lawyer to set that up? If you were personally friendly with Frank, why wouldn't he just say, yeah, come on over and we'll do that?
Okay, so this is in 88. I've just arrived. I've gone to see Skolnick in Chicago, and while I was there, Ben Johnson got screwed in the Olympics. Remember that story, Scott? Ben Johnson? I remember reading it in the newspaper in the restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
So that's September 88. And then we go out for Mae Brussels, see her the day she dies, and then she dies and we have a funeral. And I've been talking to Jerry Fialk on the phone, but I don't know him. We don't really know each other. I've ordered something through him. So I call him up and say, hey, we're going to be in L.A. in a few days. Can we get together? And he says, yeah, great. And he says, where are you staying? And we're staying at a hotel in Santa Monica. He says, well, you can stay with us or where I am at my place. And I said, oh, okay, we'll see about that. So when we got to L.A., we went over and met Jerry, liked his little place, and we stayed there for 3 weeks or something. So Jerry didn't know me. So that's on Saturday and Sunday. We go to the beach, walk around. On Monday, he goes to work, just for Zappa. And he wanted, I don't know why, but I gave him the first cassette of Who's Forgotten Furry Lynn. So he comes screaming in the house in the evening saying, what the fuck is that, Bob? I want more. And that was when he totally got flipped by Dobstown. That's when that was his virgin big orgasm, and he says, this is incredible. So we spent the next 3 weeks educating Jerry about all this other stuff, and I was into me. I was not into Frank or doing an interview or anything. I was into Jerry. Since if someone gets interested in my stuff, we don't talk about Frank anymore. We talk about me, right? Or the stuff I'm offering. So he didn't know anything about McLuhan or Mae Brussels or anything. So he was just fascinated by all this information. So he had a great 3 weeks with us. But on October 16th, he calls up, I don't even know he's doing this, he calls up Dave Porter, who has Genesis of a Music, a show on KPFK, and tells him to come over and interview me. And so Porter comes over, interviews me, and that's the interview where I said, the wall will go down pretty soon. And that's a year before. A year later, when the wall goes down, November 8th or 9th, Jerry tells me at the end of November that Porter was going through his old tapes, found this Bob interview that he'd done the year before, realized Bob had predicted it, even predicted the reunification of Germany, and he played it on November 25th. He says, hey, this guy, this wacky guy that I interviewed a year ago and never played it, but now, I don't think he, maybe he did, I don't know if he played it originally, but he played it now and emphasized my prediction. I was one of the few people in the world did. Okay, that's October 16th. Then on October 20th or so, Jerry tells me that he's talking to the lawyer, and he says, and he knows I know Frank a little bit. You know, he hears a bit of the history. But he calls up Frank's manager lawyer, and without me knowing, and says, hey, Bob's here. He knows Frank. Let him interview Frank. And so the guy says, okay, I'll ask him. Pretty quickly it comes back. Frank says through the lawyer, yeah, have Bob come over Friday night. So that's when I said, what? I got to do an interview? I said, I don't have my archives or anything here, and I don't have any way to get on the air. And I said, well, let's get Bob Marshall. So we flew Bob Marshall the next day.
A.K.A. Eddie Pusar for Scott's
Ed Pusar, yeah. And who's a good friend of Dave Neufeld. You've heard.
I know Eddie, yeah. I've met him a couple times.
Yeah, yeah. He's a very creative, whacked-out guy in his own right, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And when he and Dave get together and imitate me, it is so fucking funny. The two of them do me. Yeah. Anyways, so Bob Marshall comes out, because I said, we have to have a medium for this, because I can't get on the radio, and I don't have a show, and Bob Marshall did. He still had international connection. So I'm sitting there waiting for Marshall to fly out, and I'm thinking, okay, and I had a pretty good memory of all the key articles of Zappa and all the key points that were worthy of being developed. So I made a note of about 40 points. just from my memory of all these different articles in general. And I gave him the bar marshal, and we all went up, and you can hear a tape of us driving up. I don't know if that's on the timeline. Jerry taped us driving up to Frank's house, yelling and screaming and making fun of what we were going to do to Frank. It's pretty funny. And this is getting Bob.
Yeah, I heard that, by the way. That is funny.
Yeah. And Carol's in the car and everything, and it's like basically Bob's going to go kill Frank. You know, it's the old thing. I kill him metaphorically, you know. So we sit there, and Bob Marshall asks the questions.
He didn't, Bob. That was you. I'm not backing down on that.
Well, okay. You want to believe in your blooming reality.
Because the recall that you demonstrated during that interview could have only come from you. And I know what Eddie sounds like. We've talked with him on the phone, and
Eddie doesn't sound like what he did back then.
Yeah,
it's totally.
You can call it Bob Marshall if you want to make it one of your alter egos, but that was you. That was you and Carolyn. I'm not even sure Eddie was there. I'm not sure I heard him on the tape at all, to be honest.
He was me. Now here's the thing: is that. He did not know Zappa's work that well. He used my notes. If you notice, he just says, well, you did an interview in 1953 and said this and blah, blah, blah. That's how he does the interview.
Mm-hmm.
He starts off, I told him to say this, cite the information is not knowledge, knowledge is not wisdom, that whole thing. Then when Zappa says the end, music is the best. And so if you hear the interview, Bob starts to cite it, and he doesn't know it, and Frank has to finish it. Frank says, well, we're going to quote it. Let's do it right. So then Frank spiels it off, and at the end he goes, music is the best. So then Bob goes, well, what is music? And that's how it begins.
Mm.
It starts with the basics. It's really good. It's perfect. Yeah. It's a question no one, and I told him to say that. Say, when he gets to the end, say, what is music? So I
got a question for Scott. Scott, have you gone in extensively on any level? Gone in and listened to the Zappa opus?
You mean the Zappa interview?
No. I mean his collection of 60 records or whatever he produced in his lifetime.
His music.
His music, yeah.
Well, I think like I've said before, I've been.
A little resistant or reluctant to get into.
Well, I mean, I grew up liking a bunch of Zappa songs,
uh-huh.
Like Mothers of Invention songs. My brother had like a Verve compilation, which was if there's ever such a thing as the greatest hits of the Mothers of Invention, that was it. It was like, you know, Wowie Zowie and all the really kind of accessible songs. As a kid, I really liked those songs. I thought they were funny. And then through the 70s and 80s, something about Zappa kind of turned me off, but I didn't
because either because he was vulgar or because he just sounded so differently from everybody else, it was hard to relate to.
It might have been the vulgarity a little bit, although I liked other stuff that would have been maybe considered vulgar too, but I mean maybe it was just the brashness mixed with the vulgarity. I don't know what it was. It was just. And then also, I mean, I think I was influenced by a lot of rock critics, you know, and I let them make up my mind for me. I didn't, like I said, I didn't really look into it myself. And, you know, the line on Zappa was that he was just pretentious and pompous, and he hated rock and roll and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we've talked about that in
discussions. Yeah. Well, he hated rock critics, and so they probably hated him back. I mean, I imagine.
That's what I kind of always assumed or whatever. But, and then it was actually. You know, then I became really good friends with Dave Neufeld in the mid-80s, and I found out what a huge Zappa fan he was. But I was still kind of, it made me more intrigued about him. But I remember once I was at Dave's place, and I think we got pretty high or something, and he was throwing all these Zappa things on, and I was kind of like, very much keeping it to myself, but I was like, oh man, I don't know, I don't think I like this shit at all. This is like, I just can't get into this. And Dave was like totally enthused about it and stuff, and it was like, and then, I don't know, I think it was partly just reading Ben Watson's book a couple years ago that got me into it. And now, I mean, I would say I've probably delved into, I don't know, a sixth of the catalog, maybe. Like, I know all the 60s Mothers of Invention stuff quite well. And then the solo stuff going up to about maybe the mid-70s, although I don't know that stuff inside out, but I've listened to it all. And I've probably listened to a bit of the later stuff, just sort of songs here and there. But, I mean, I'm totally fascinated by Frank Zappa now. Like, I actually have a completely different, just a completely different feeling about for the guy and about the guy than I
because
did
you found
five
the
years
interview.
Ago. Like,
because you found the, because you found the YouTube interviews.
Yeah, that was part of it. No, that was part of it. But, I mean, even before that, I think it was more like the Bob and Ben stuff. And just the fact, I like the way that you guys, you know, you don't really talk much about Zappa, but it's still sort of, your whole thing is kind of rooted in Zappa. And I don't know, it just kind of made me intrigued. I thought, you know, I really got to fucking check out Zappa and listen to this stuff and make up my own mind about it. And I kind of like the fact that, like, a lot of it, I still kind of, like, don't have total use for, but it just, because he sort of tried everything, I find it really interesting. Even the stuff that I would kind of pass over, I don't know, I find it really hard to sort of be critical of almost anything he's done now. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, the we don't talk in detail about Zappa. We're explaining the tradition of Zappa. That's what's
right. That's
the tradition he's part of, the Manipian tradition. That's unique. That's never been said ever before what we talk about.
Yeah.
We talk about McLuhan and Finney's Wake, Lewis and the Vortices, and that's the, and Ben loves some of the Vortices because that's British. That's his gang. And, you know, his claim to fame. France has got Picasso and the Cubists, and Britain's got the Vortices, but they don't promote the Vortices. They're only starting now. They featured Wyndham Lewis's portraits last summer. That was a big success. But the, in 2008, I think. But that is the tradition that Frank is part of.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what about you, Scott? Why were you wondering about me, and why, and what's your own thing in regard to Zappa?
Yeah, well, you know, there are a number of coincidental things that, you know, when I was years before I met Bob, I had keyed, you know, I was in a bookstore and I keyed in on Finnegan's Wake, and I thought, gee, this is something I got to know about, but not being highly intellectual and not much of a literate person to begin with, you know, it was like I would look at it and go, I gotta find out what this is about, but I wasn't about to actually try to read it
without reading it.
Yeah. and I also keyed in without having really heard Zappa's music. I just think that saw a poster of him or magazine article, and I thought, gee, this is somebody I got to find out about, but he's not accessible to me right now. You know, because I was into Jimi Hendrix and Cream and all the 60s stuff that I was, you know, it tuned my ear for music so different, radically different from what Zappa was doing that I could hardly relate to it, but I knew I had to find out about it. And then these years later, I meet Bob and Jerry, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm hearing about Zappa's genius, and now all of a sudden it's becoming accessible to me. And also, I could find humor in some of his sarcasm that I might not have been able to relate to, because, you know, I mean, he would make fun of some of my rock heroes doing satire on them and stuff, and so it wasn't later until he became accessible. And then after meeting Bob, actually it was after Bob and I were, whenever Bob and I are in town at the same time, Bob doesn't have a car, and I always volunteer to be Bob's chauffeur, and we drive around and do stuff. And I had brought some, half a dozen Zappa albums that I brought with me, and this car that I rented had a great stereo. And we were rocking out so hard to Zappa, and I was so catching the buzz from Bob, you know, he Bob just wanted to crank it, you know, and I sort of got this infection. So when I got home, I realized that, you know, there's a couple of used record stores around here, and you can find, I pretty much have Zappa's entire collection, things that I'd just pick up for $6, $8, $8.50, whatever, here and there. And then it became something that I became absorbed in just listening to all of it, going through it. Is opus the right word for an artist's collection? I don't know if that's the proper word, but going through his extensive output of music, and you know, not all of it. I don't groove to all of it, but I can find a way into it. It's all of it shows facets of his genius. And so it's sort of an exploration of his genius that, and then through hearing what he was doing and what he was exploring and the multi the levels of as Bob refers to as his Manippean satire or his social criticisms, as well as the you know, writing music that he, you know, I think Bob said that, you know, when if Zappa came out with an album that was successful with his fans, he'd try to figure out how to come out with something that would offend his fans or put them off, or do he didn't want to be labeled, he didn't want to be made into any kind of an image that you could close the book on and say, well, now we know who he is. And so all of that, I guess that's the long answer to your question.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I encourage people to take a, if they have any inclination at all, to dive in and listen to what he was doing.
Strange thing about Zap is I wouldn't know where to begin to tell someone to start. I mean,
yeah.
That's the Manippean tradition.
Young people don't get Zappa at all. Like, I find there's very few young people who, like, he's got a kind of a pretty bad reputation among young writers anyway. I mean, people kind of just will say a dismissive comment about Zappa because he really does have this reputation of being, like, you know, difficult for difficulty's sake or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird, yeah. I mean, they'll just, so I've seen stuff, you know, he's almost used as a pejorative or whatever, Zappa.
Well, now, have you heard the, what was the radio interview, the Canadian radio interview, Bob? They did like 2-hour, not an interview, but a 2-hour, like 3-hour documentary on Zappa?
Yeah, last.
Oh, was that the CBC thing?
Yeah.
Have you
heard that, Scott?
Yeah, I've listened to some of it. There's also a good one. Have you guys listened to the one Jazz from Hell, the Charles Char Murray thing?
I don't think I have.
What's that?
Oh, you know where you can get that, actually, is if you you know, on like Ben's whatever is his home or his like what's that
archive.org.
Yeah, if you search Frank Zappa, I'm pretty sure you'll find it. It's a 3-part series called Jazz from Hell. It's narrated by Charles Char Murray, and it's quite good. It's got some really amazing interview clips. Like, he interviews, you know, all sorts of people who have played with Zappa over the years, and it's basically about Frank Zappa as a jazz, like the jazz side of Frank Zappa. And it's cool because the whole sort of premise is, you know, that we're going to spend 3 hours over 3 episodes talking about Frank Zappa, the jazz musician, but understand that Frank Zappa has nothing to do with jazz. it's very Bob-ish in a way, like,
yeah.
the premise of it and the way they. And, you know, but then it's much more of kind of a strict documentary sort of style. But it's good. They keep kind of going back to that point. Like, Frank didn't really want anything to do with jazz. And what he was doing was, you know, something, he was just kind of doing it. And he would argue with his musicians that, no, this isn't jazz. So don't tell me to, you know, play stuff in a jazz style or something, because that's not what we're doing.
Right. Charles Char Murray, he was the main interviewer of Frank of New Musical Express in the 70s, say, maybe even started in the 60s. And I knew that, and so when I went to London once, I went to the library and got all the New Music Expresses and went through and got all the interviews. And Charles Char Murray was a major guy. I may have known this back then, but I forgot about it. But knowing Ben last year and starting to talk about Frank, Charles Char Murray is the anti-Ben, you know. Ben is very pissed off that Char Murray couldn't take Zappa later or something, dropped off and turned New Musical Express against Zappa, something like that. And so Ben, I remember him saying, might even be on the show, he objects to Char Murray's effort to make Frank acceptable by saying he's a jazz guy or this whole jazz thing. So Ben doesn't even like that approach.
Right. But, and I think I remember hearing Ben say that, yeah, maybe even in his book he might mention Charles Char Murray. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think he does because he's the Robert Christgau, I guess, of over there, one of those.
Kind of, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
On
he's
that
one of
level.
The big, yeah, he's one of the big guys. For sure.
Yeah, and Ben, I think Ben's the best of all of them, but Ben's too ornery. He's not going to be a bland guy that they can use. So I like Ben's outsider status, but he's like Lester Bangs saying he's better than Bukowski. You know, Ben says he's better than Charles Char Murray.
Yeah, yeah.
The same cultural thing. So why are we... Okay, yeah.
Well, so I just wanted to finish up and say the obvious, which is the reason I evoke the CBC documentary, was because
you get to
hear how passionate the musicians who worked for him were, how he pushed them beyond any limits they thought they could ever get past in themselves, but he inspired them to really want to do stuff they didn't think they could do, and so some of these musicians got an education of a lifetime, and when you hear their praise of wanting to practically die for this guy or whatever, it's a little bit of a disclaimer to the idea that, well, he just wanted to be difficult for difficulty's sake.
He was anti-environmental. He was the very, you're saying the next generation, young kids, 2-3 generations later, don't like Frank. That happens to all the Menippians. Joyce, they don't even teach Joyce in university anymore.
Yeah.
The Don Seale used to rave on about that. The lefty feminists took over. And they didn't want any Joyce or any patriarchal guy or something stupid. So McLuhan is not appreciated by young people. Zappa isn't. Joyce would definitely Wyndham Lewis. So that's the Menippean tradition. You're only... Even McLuhan despaired in the 40s. He says you're never going to be able to make Lewis a mainstream thing. And,
yeah.
And McLuhan himself couldn't be made mainstream, even though paradoxically he did affect the language. But that's for the very reasons McLuhan explained.
And McLuhan survived as a brand name, kind of.
Yeah.
People know, McLuhan. Like, they know the name, and, the medium is the message. They hone it down just to that. I read someone recently said, oh, yeah, I finally, read some McLuhan. It's pretty simple to understand. And I thought, well, how much did you read?
Yeah. How much did you read? You didn't read did you know he
like,
did 22?
Is it really that simple? Like, and I know this guy's writing, too, and I'm like, I don't know if I'm not going to totally take you at your word that you just right. You're almost writing it off as being like it wasn't a diss, but it was like, oh yeah, no. I looked at the McLuhan stuff. It's pretty straightforward, really.
Right. What they don't
really?
Know
I
is
don't
that
know.
No. Here's the thing. It is simpler now for people.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They don't know that that's not McLuhan. That's the act. That's the voice of the end or meme talking. They don't even
right.
know the theatrical level of it. And you find that out when you read McLuhan's literary criticism or other things. You say, shit, he doesn't even believe the medium is a message. He's trying to point out that you people are acting as if the medium is a message. So if you actually understand McLuhan, you're inside the matrix. You don't recognize it. That's why McLuhan always referred back to Finney's Wake. He said, you want to understand me? You got to master Finney's Wake. Nobody can do that, but that's the beginning, and they won't know that he said that, so they wouldn't even ask themselves, well, why does he want me to understand Finney's Wake? So in that level, my stuff is a phenomenal university education, way beyond what any education. It's like a secret school, because I spell all this out in the Fatty Communion talks with Scott, hours and hours, and it's all there. I spell it out. You have to go through it to find out you didn't know. And that's what I love about I love Meltzer. He would be amazed at what I'm reading his stuff and translating it, because him and Christgau and all of them don't know what happened, where it came from. They don't know what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Bob and I just wanted to say, you know, regarding last week's cash flow show, that was awesome. The dialogue that you had you know,
about technology.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to commit to whether or not I believe that's Marshall McLuhan or I believe Ion is capable of putting on Marshall McLuhan. But the dialogue you had with Marshall McLuhan was very. I mean, it was revealing on a lot of levels, and some good stuff came out of that. And you know, when you asked him if he completed, you know, if you completed his work, I thought that the response was interesting.
Yeah, no, it was really good.
What did he say? I didn't catch that show.
Oh, it's very. You know, I talked to Shoki, who did the PhD on McLuhan in art history, and she heard it, and she says, you know, I couldn't understand what McLuhan was saying. That's how good it was. She says, I knew it was something amazing, but I couldn't follow it. And so we can't translate it. He goes on about all different angles of what I did with it.
But what did he say to the question Scott just mentioned? What was it? Do you complete McLuhan or something?
Yeah, he answered that. But you listen to his answer, man. It's a complex answer.
Okay.
Isn't it, Scott?
Yeah, it is complex. You know, it doesn't entirely validate your take on McLuhan, but it also does validate your take on McLuhan. It just you're emphasizing a certain aspects of his work. You know, I think he said, you know, you completed some of it, some of what we were beginning to do. You missed some of it. It was a fair critique.
Yeah, and now here's the thing. That is Marshall talking for the general audience. You got to hear me and Marshall talking to Ion privately or through Ion. There's a whole bunch of other stuff we've talked about, you know, privately.
Right.
With Ion and private readings. I won't go into it all. I'm not going to go into it, but there's a lot more than you hear on the radio show. But the radio show is powerful enough for people, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw Frader. You know, he's the guy who calls in as Alex and says, I'm at work, so I'll ask a question and I'll listen to the answer when I get a chance to hear the archives.
Well, he calls in as Frader, and you address him as Alex, but his real name is Matt, so...
That's right. Well, he says he's Frader, but he says, call me... The first time he called in, he says, this is Frader, I think, and you know me, Bob, but I'm going to be called Alex.
Oh, okay.
And so anyways, look at what he just... I just noticed before I called you... what he said on Five Body, the boat. He just got around to hearing last week's show, and he has a whole interesting thread. He's trying to find out, he's just trying to figure out what the hell is Ion, and is Bob gone too far with this? You know, have you read that thread? It's called...
I looked at it briefly.
Well, there's one called Hello, Governor. Then there's...
Because you're arguing about whether they're entities.
Yeah, whether he's channeling or not, right. And
right.
Then he posts a new one. He saw me on the timeline, me and Nelson with Leary, and he calls it on Leary freaking out as he encounters Bob for first time. And I think it's in that thread. He goes on a bunch of other stuff about Bob, and then he says, Yeah, he's talking about Bob and all this. Then he goes, by the way, hour two of the last cash flow was off the chain! Exclamation mark. He goes, it's really getting good. Holy moly! That's what it is. This is the most amazing performance that's ever been heard by humans.
Why am I having difficulty getting into the Ion stuff?
Well, you just have to listen to the radio shows.
Yeah.
No, if you're not listening, I don't know what you're. What are you listening to? If it's not.
Well, maybe the problem is that I'm like, see, a lot of your stuff I actually try and listen to at work because I can, you know, slip on a headphone,
right.
an earphone kind of thing, and sometimes pretend I'm doing actual work, or sometimes actually doing actual work, and you know, and then I'll pause stuff a lot, and then I'll go back to it. And but I don't know what it is. I'm fine. Like with the first hour of some of the Ion shows, I'm having difficulty keeping my concentration on it, so I'm not completing the shows, and I'm thinking, God, I don't know what it is. I gotta like, because it's getting all these good reviews, and I'm sure there's stuff here I'm missing.
Yeah, you can't do it at work. Ed Pusar said the other day to Steve, he says, you know, he's doing his carpentry on his apartment. He's very busy. He said, I try to listen to the stuff in the background, but I can't. It's too interesting, and I have to stop. So I can't do two things at once. You can't do two things at once, really, listen to the show, because it's... So what it is you listen just the first hour. Ion's just warming up. it gets roaring in the second hour, and then it goes over the top in the third hour every time.
Okay.
Right, Scott?
Yeah, it's getting better too. As you know, each week I think that it's getting better. And also, you know, like Zappa, takes some acclimation. Like I said, he wasn't accessible to me until I met somebody who could make him accessible, namely Bob and Jerry.
Right.
And Ion, it takes acclimation. I had been interested in a channel that channeled from the non-phenomenal dimensions, you know, 30 years ago, who captured my imagination. So I already, when Bob started working with Ion, he was already kind of accessible to me because I was kind of familiar with the phenomena. But it's easy to brush it off as being crazy stuff if you have no way to key in on what's going on there. And I still have, I think, reasonable doubts about some of what Ion has to say in terms of making predictions or giving detailed information, which is difficult, if not impossible, to actually track down and verify. But nevertheless, and I'm getting past my resistance to that, the quality of the advice that he gives in general is, I'm finding it to be pretty useful, pretty good stuff.
Yeah, the...
I have to give it another try. I guess maybe sometimes I'm listening to it and I'm expecting to be blown away by it, and it doesn't feel that way, and that's, you know, just my own expectation.
Yeah, not... You never know when it starts to blow you away. I mean, Frater, he listened to the shows, and this is interesting, but most people are hearing the platitudes, and they think, well, it sounds like other New Age stuff. They don't know that Ion doesn't believe in the platitudes he's saying. But he has to say, he always says, it's not our ideas, these are your words, your ideas. So we're mirroring it back to you. But Frater, who's a therapist in a hospital and has worked with autistic children, he just happened to be hearing a show and autism came up. And he listened to Ion's answer and he says, holy shit, that's exactly the truth. He says, that's what I know is going on there. But I can't say it among my colleagues because it's too radical to say that, but that's what I really believe. And he said, at that point, I said, this Ion is real, because he come up with something I know about, and he has a real take on it, and it's way different from what everybody else is saying, but Alex Frater knew it in his own mind. So things like that is what triggers you. And the email I get from clients who have private readings are incredible. This one person said, for the next week, I'd get random bouts of euphoria. This is euphoria would overtake me. Now, that's because Ion massages the non-physical of ourselves. That's what's really going on. And the impressive thing is that Ion goes from one area of talk to another. Buzz says, he doesn't know what to make of Ion, but he says, I'm a great bullshitter, Buzz says. I'm a great bullshitter. I know how to bullshit. But I am in awe at the bullshit that Ion can come up with immediately on any topic. And that's what's impressive, the speed that he relates to and goes into details during the show with all the different questions.
Well, I've had that thought too. If I want to think of you, Bob, in terms of being the best bullshitter, and when you're talking to Ion, it sounds like you're talking to your own higher self or something.
Yeah. You mean Bob's higher self?
Yeah, Bob's higher self. I mean, he's got Bob, you know, snookered.
Yeah, I just sit back and say, there's my boy. Look at my boy. He's taking life further than me.
Yeah. But I also appreciate the honesty with which you challenge him or ask him questions that could reveal things even unflattering about yourself. Like, for instance, you'll go into some of your media ecology ideas and he'll kind of stand back and go, don't think so, Bob. You know, and then he'll come up with a coherent
rebuttal
that actually is quite pleasing to hear, And then you'll fight back with him and say, nah, you know, I'm holding to my guns on this technology thing. And then you can kind of flip back into your view, and you can sort of flip back and forth between the views and see that there's some truth in both what you have to say.
Yeah, and then you bring Carol in and takes on the medicine. That's a whole other amazing interplay, and that makes it an even neater dynamic going on.
Right.
Is she skeptical of what he says? Because doesn't he say stuff like... smoke as many cigarettes and eat as much sugar as you want?
Well, what?
Yeah, in the last show, Carolyn asked him about there's these regulations coming down which are going to potentially put companies that make vitamins and nutritional supplements, you know, under FDA control, you know, under prescription regulation. And she's saying, how can we stop this from happening? I mean, what's the solution to this, Ion? And Ion says, well, just start drinking sewage because it has more vitamins in it than half the food you're eating anyway. And, you know, I mean, that is so antithetical to Carolyn's philosophy of health, but yet she's willing to consider what he's saying, that there's something true about what you're saying at the essential level of that we are creating our experience of the world, you know, based on our deepest beliefs about how we've put things together. And yeah, you know, she kind of admits, yeah, you know, if you're really that in tune with yourself, you probably could live on sewage. But then, you know, somebody asks her, you know, about how do I deal with you know, particular symptom, and you know, she comes up with all of the homeopathic and vitamin supplements and dietary things that you ought to be taking into consideration. But it's amazing to me that she has the flexibility to not resist Ion and to let him have his say, and to honor that's true too. But you know, she doesn't. You know, it's fun.
It's very impressive what she does, and she did she's done a medical book with Ion. They've gone through all the diseases, and I've heard bits of it, not all of it. And they argue all the way through it. And so this arguing you're hearing Carolyn do on the show is old hat with her and Ion. She's been doing it since March. And but the thing is, one thing that they agreed to agree on, this sort of thing. Carolyn said, look, somebody calls me up and they got a real problem, yeast or something. I do not tell them. I cannot tell them just to relax and allow. And Ion says, we agree. He says, in the interim, I may get to that level later, once they've peeled off all these infections and everything and done all what I can do for them, I may later get to that level when they're better, but in the meantime, I got to do with this middle ground stuff. And Ion said, you're perfectly right. And so they understand what they're doing. But when you're doing a radio show, it's kind of like showbiz, so she doesn't say everything and just lets it ride. And, you know, I don't know how you describe it. You're not getting the whole show on cash flow, but it's already too much for people. So there's a lot more going on behind the scenes with Ion and me and Carolyn, you know, that we've done. I don't know. See, here's the thing. Ion even said it, I think, last show. We rehearse the show Tuesday nights when we do Melting Titanium, which goes for 2 hours, our ESP show. A lot of things that we can't talk about on cash flow, I'll go through them with on Melting Titanium, and it seems to be okay there because it's just people who got ESP hearing it, and then we sort of figure out what we can say maybe on cash flow if the topic comes up. So it's interesting. Melting Titanium is a rehearsal, sort of going through the themes that we have had during the week in private reading. I mean, I do this every day with Ion, at least 3 hours a day.
Right. Okay.
So this is an amazing, you know, Manhattan Project going on here. And so we process it all week, then we filter it through Melting Titanium. No, we do it all in Melting Titanium, then we filter for cash flow. But I'm often surprised. Ion breaks the rules occasionally, goes further than what we agreed not to bring up. It's almost like Ion says, Bob, you don't bring up this stuff because you'll go and pursue it and too much will come out. Let the audience ask the questions, and then I'll figure out whether they answered or not. You know what I mean? That's what we're doing here. It's pretty, like, you won't believe, like last night, there's this story. Have you heard of this woman got caught shooting? She shot three fellow professors at University of Alabama?
Yeah.
This is a huge, huge story. I did not know. Buzz sent the article. I read it to Ion, and then, fuck, you wouldn't believe what came out. It is a huge, huge, incredible story, and we cannot talk about it. While I, on the second night, maybe it was the first night, we've done several nights on it, the second night, this is a few nights ago, the phone starts blinking, his phone. That means that National Security Agency or someone of that level is listening to our talk and taping it and monitoring it. So we started going into this, and Ian says, well, this happened, that happened, Bob. And then he said, well, wait a minute, phone's blinking. Is it your phone, Bob? No, it's not ours. Okay, it's ours. It's JW's. So he says, okay, we'll just carry on. So we talked, and we went on for about 20 minutes or something. And then Ian said, okay, the blinking stopped. Now I'll tell you everything, Bob. And then he laid out the fucking really what was going on. So he'd been soft-pedaling it while we were being monitored. Now think of this. Who's going to believe me that I got fucking CIA or whatever monitoring? Nobody's going to believe that. But I'm telling you, that's what's happening. We have it on tape. And in the future, when more comes out, we'll play the tape and you'll hear it. So...
Yeah, but then you jest with Ion on cash flow that, President Obama and his staff are listening to your show, and you know that's a ridiculous statement to make. So it becomes blurry as to where to draw the line.
Scott, that is puny that the White House is listening. We know everything Obama. That's why people listen. Our beeping goes on all the time because they're listening to find out what's going on because they know. And these are very advanced intelligence agencies. They know what ION is, and they need to know. So they monitor. So on the on cash flow, when I said, well, what's the White House think about this or that, and or something, and he says, well, they're listening right now.
Yeah, he said that at one point, and then on another show, he revealed that they're not listening,
Oh, no, they are listening. I didn't hear that second part. If he did that, that's him just erasing the effect, because it's very, very catch, very, I don't know, what'd you call it? He's very cautious.
Well, because you asked him straight. You said, and again, it was hard to tell whether this was in jest or not. You said, well, what does Obama think about you saying that on the radio or whatever? And he said, oh, I know, you were talking about that desk made of that special wood or whatever.
Yeah, the blue desk.
And he said, well... He Ion said, I'm going to have to paraphrase,
yeah.
But Ion said, he wouldn't, if he doesn't know about it already, he's not going to believe us.
Yeah, Obama himself will not believe us.
Yeah, so why would Obama be listening to a show where he doesn't even believe the content of the program? It's ridiculous.
He's not listening. His staff is listening.
Oh.
As Ion has said many times, the smart one in that family is Michelle. Obama's not too bright. He doesn't understand. The basic thing about Obama, and a client found this out. They said, what's happening with Obama or something? I think it was a black person. And Obama said, Ion said, Obama has always, since he was young, wanted to be president.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got to be president, after a while, he said, what the hell was I thinking?
I believe that.
And that is, that's the dumbness that Obama had. He was naive. And he went through the Harvard and the total success thing. He believed in the goddamn white man hologram. And then he found out he was set up. You know,
it's funny that you say that, Bob, because I've been noticing Obama lately. He's made a couple of references recently to... the possibility that, oh, maybe I will only be a one-term president. And I've literally been thinking lately, this guy sounds like he's actually, he wants out maybe. It's weird.
No, he does. No, we got a lot of detail on his psyche and all that. I mean, everybody's saying he was born in Kenya. No, he's born in Indonesia. And only Ion would know that. But the point is that when I said something about the White House, and Ion said, they're listening now. And then we all kind of laughed. Oh, okay, they're listening now. But I knew that they listened. But it's not Obama. It's his staff. And the staff knows more than Obama. Obama's just a robot. He's just told what to say. That's all it is. It's a controlled environment that he's in. But the staff has to come up with stuff to tell them what to say. It's their jobs are on the line. They're all over the place trying to find stuff. You know, one of our regular listeners is Denzel Washington. And we've got executives. We've got executives in Hollywood listening. And James didn't know this. And he told me last week that his neighbor, her son, made a movie, he's a producer, that won an Oscar nomination. And so she moved out, gave the son's name to James. James emailed him, got him, I didn't even know this, got him to listen to Ion, and the guy wrote back, this is great stuff. And that was said to me about 2 days after Ion was telling me about the Hollywood guys listening. It was already happening through James, but I didn't know that. So anyways, the thing is that the staff has to come up with stuff, and they're scouring all over the place. And who knows how they found us, but they say, well, this is an interesting source.
Well, there's nothing being said on the show that's relevant to the needs, the necessity of the White House.
About Air France, about Michael Jackson, all kinds of things are being talked about. That's what Obama has to deal with. He had to make a statement of Michael Jackson.
People at that level of the conventional consensus reality are going to believe somebody talking about portals into parallel worlds and stuff?
Well, you don't know who these people are, Scott. You'd be amazed at where the intelligent and aware people are.
Yeah, well, I can't.
Don't follow the TV stereotypes.
I could see like them tuning in.
Oh yeah, because
that doesn't seem implausible to me, because they're probably tuning into, you know, all sorts of shit out there.
Well, how much time do they have to tune into entertainment shows on the media? They got fucking work to do every day.
No, they don't have any work to do. Their work is to find stuff for Obama to say and to be aware of the reaction of. And so here it is. The national security, the agencies are listening. There's people in the White House who are in touch with the agency. Now, when Ion's saying the White House is listening, it could be somebody in the communications department, not the guy doing the press conference or anything. It's just somebody in the staff.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I'm sure the staff is like so humongous that there's people you never will ever hear about too. Right?
That's right. And they are factual.
The personalities in front are the people, you know. We all know like, you know, 20 of the big players or something like that, and they all have huge staffs themselves.
That's right. And so the staff, every faction's got a representative in there.
I mean, yeah, exactly.
Ian was telling me about in the details of the Kennedy assassination and how the mafia had a guy in the communications department of the White House. And that's how they knew where Kennedy was going to go when he went to Dallas.
So, Bob, have you ever done stuff in person with JW?
Yeah, I visited him. I only got to know him by phone in early 2006 after Carol met him in Atlanta through a social connection just by an accident, and that was she met him in December 2005. I started talking to him in February 2006 because he remembered Carol had mentioned something about her husband said this or that, and he wanted to find out more. So we got talking, and then we became good friends over the phone, and then in April 2007 we went to his place in Bremen, Georgia, and we spent a week there.
So, like, is he, like, is he private about what he does?
Very private about what he does.
Like, do people know? Like, does he not, like, let on that he's this? Like, does he just do his work kind of over the phone and on your radio show and stuff?
No.
Like, that's what I'm...
That's what I say is literally true. This is our team. I said before Ion even showed up that our team would bring forth Cold Fusion. Well, bringing forth Cold Fusion, not that simple. You got to have a whole revolution going on other levels. And then Ion showed up, and then JW said, woo! So we went forward with Ion as part of our PR program for Cold Fusion. See, this is so monumental. This is global Shakespearean theater. This is, and I don't mean theater meaning fiction, this is dramatic,
right?
What's going on. When people find out who JW is, they'll know why he kept it quiet who he was. You can't find anything on him on the Internet. And
what do you mean when they find out who he is? Like, is some, like...
Well, the one, he is well-known on a certain circuit. Well-known.
Okay.
And when those guys find out, that's going to be interesting. Now, one of them found out. It's a friend of JW's. Called up. The secretary called up and said, what are you doing? And JW said, just playing. And they said, okay. And that was JW talking. That wasn't Ion. But JW just said, don't worry, we're not doing anything. What's that line? Move along, nothing happening here. But that person who phoned, you all know who that person is.
Really?
Yeah. So, anyways, and I'm not making this up. I don't waste my time with nonsense. If this wasn't interesting or a living thing, I wouldn't be involved. The platitudes that Ion says, that's not the issue. Ion is massaging consciousness all over the planet as this is happening on the show. That's why clients, they say, wow, I got a really strange reaction. Freighter, he collapsed after the thing, and his girlfriend, his wife, well, I can't go into that part. But
he was the one who freaked out a bit or something?
Yeah, he freaked out. He went into, I don't know, paroxysms of paranoia. He's calmed down and now tells everybody to have a reading, but it's a powerful interaction. I mean, I get to hear them every day, these clients. It's incredible what Ion says. You never know what he's going to say. Every one of them just gets into a state of, you know, laughing insights, and it's pretty neat. The only guy I didn't have a good time was Scott.
That's true. I think I was maybe the sixth person to talk to him, and I had already had him. I wasn't trying to test him so much as I'd already had a measure by which I was going, a standard by which I was going to measure him, and that was because I had had contact with a non-phenomenal channeled being in my 20s, and I'd had a private conversation with him, and he demonstrated beyond any shadow of my doubt that he intimately knew the patterns and the makeup of my life. And he didn't query me or ask me questions or any leading questions at all. All he asked me was my name, my age, and where I was calling from. And wanted to know my age because he wanted to figure out where I was on the timeline in my experience, because he says all time is happening all the time now anyway. But when I talked to Ion, you know, I asked him questions without giving him any leading information, and the answers that I got didn't register as being authentically having to do with anything with me personally or my private life or my private experience. So I got really pissed off. I was pissed off for a long time. And I remember the Evergreen said that the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. And I don't know if that's what was happening for me, is that I'm confronting something that is real, and I can't quite, and I'm resisting working it through all my logic circuits. But one day when I talk to Ion again, I'm going to fucking confront him about
a lot of things.
Shit where I think he's either winging it or that he's very, very good at the art of extrapolation. You give him a little bit of information and he can unpack it and extrapolate and give it back to you and make and give you the sense that, you know, oh, wow, that guy's really psychic or something, when really he's, you know, but I cannot deny, and I may I hope I find out I'm wrong about that eventually. But besides that, his intelligence is enormous, and the source of his being is certainly not harmful at all. He's actually, I think he's being of great benefit to people that want to open themselves up to his influence.
Yeah, the something about your you were saying.
And then after that we hung up, Bob reported to me that Ion said that was the most resistant human we've ever talked to.
That's right. And the I wanted to say, well, what's good on Scott's part? He was pissed off, but once Ion showed up on the radio, he says, okay, I'll listen to this idiot on the radio. And then after a while, he saw other aspects because he had the guts to listen to him on the radio as the show's unfolded.
Well, the interplay between you and him is what makes it fun, Bob. And also, I'll mention for Scott's sake that I ordered a couple of private talks from the Ion website on the subject of death and dying. I think I ordered three of them, and I found them to be more satisfying than what goes on the air. The private, I only wished I had access to Bob's private talks with Ion, because they are fun.
Yeah.
So the one you ordered is Bob and Ion?
No, you go on there. We have a catalog section, and there's, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 topics. We do alchemy. This one's called, So How's It Feel to Be Stone Cold Dead?
Okay.
And it turned out to be 3 CDs. Maybe you've only heard 2, Scott. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know if you've got the third one. Can't remember. But he's heard two-thirds of it anyways, and it's pretty good. And it's just really interesting what goes on between me, Ian, and Carolyn, you know, in the sessions. It's actually unique.
Yeah, I mean, on the radio, you get, because it's the radio, yeah. it extends the illusion of, well, this is entertainment. But when you hear Bob and Ion privately, and you hear that, the way that Bob is sort of relentless at attempting to decipher Ion, and how carefully Ion is to let Bob know that he didn't, he's not quite getting it. Let's see if we can find another way to say it. And that there's really somebody on the other end of the line who's quite authentic and quite intelligent.
Yeah. And that's just from that reading. You wait to get to hear all the topics we offer and more. Carolyn's doing this incredible, it's up to 4 sessions now on love, which is pretty amazing.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, here's what I'll just say. The headline would be, love is not emotion. Love is not emotion. It is a force field.
Ah.
And then it goes from there, and Ion goes into sociology, physics, culture, art, everything. It's always, it's like the first time non-physical gives its view of everything and shows how everything interrelates from the non-physical point of view.
The one grievance I have of Bob that I hope that I can overcome the resistance to eventually is that as fascinated as I am with what he has to say, I'm not sure that my life has actually transformed for the better as a result of speaking with him privately or listening to what he has to say. I tend to digest this stuff as being more stuff for my intellect to consume and understand. It doesn't necessarily go all the way through into whatever it is in me that would be practically speaking transformational. I tend to see that in part as a function of my own being maybe a little disconnected and sort of cerebral or intellectualizing the world around me. But it's the reason why I haven't been willing to really jump in and spend money is because, you know, I can get great ideas from anywhere. I can, I've got a library of great ideas, intellectual things to ponder, things to think about, satisfying and rewarding things to think about, you know, from the hundreds of hours of stuff that I have of you alone, Bob. But it's, I'm still looking for the key or whatever it is in me that has to change. And I think that can only come from within me. I don't think even if Ion is all that he says he is, I don't think there's any real help I can get from him other than, that's an interesting thought, but something in me, and it has to come from within me, has to change.
Well, remember, Ion, you might have heard it, Ion doesn't care about you, cannot change you, says that all the time, has no effect on you. But the paradox is that Ion is our non-physical, and because we're hearing it talk to ourselves, back to us, it affects us. So you don't know how it's affecting you, but Ion on the stated level says, I'm not responsible for you, Scott. Everything's okay. When you transition, it's all ecstasy, and we recommend that you stay in the physical as long as you can, because it's nothing over here. It's easy over here. You want to be able to have the non-physical in your life, in the physical, and never have to transition.
Yeah, well, that's what the, you know, that reference that's attributed to Jesus, you know, as it is in, you know, on earth as it is in heaven. You know, I believe that.
Yep, that's the name of the trilogy that they're doing with Carolyn. It's Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done, and I think it's As It Is
on Earth as It Is in Heaven.
Yeah, as in heaven, and that's the ideology. That's the point. You will be here forever. And then there's the whole ramifications of why Ion is showing up. And McLuhan described what was happening because of the medium of the environment and why things appeared to change, resonated with the characteristics of the new environment. I'm telling people on Five Bodies, Ion is a new medium, a new environment announcing itself. And it makes total logic, total sense to go to understand why Ion shows up now in relation to all that's happening to the culture. I mean, we reached information utopia with the Internet.
Yeah.
All everybody's waiting for is something like free energy, and then we made it. but there's a lot involved in this, so it's totally logical that
you haven't accomplished what your stated goal was from the day I first met you many years ago, which is the bringing in of the cold fusion technology. That hasn't happened, and Ion on the last show said they unlocked the keys to that in the 1920s. The reason why it hasn't come forward, as best as I can paraphrase or believe what Ion was pointing to, is because the collective consciousness can't let it in yet and doesn't believe in it, and therefore it cannot come into manifestation until enough people actually are willing to embrace and allow it to come in.
Right. Now, then Ion said something he's never said before. He said, and once it's in, people will start getting cancer from it.
Right, and Carolyn clarified that by saying that's if it's brought in as an environment and people can't creation by default. You have to be sort of co-creating and allowing it into your experience, because if it's forced on you or impinged upon you from the outside and you can't reconcile yourself with it, it'll end up making you sick.
And so that proves that I am bringing cold fusion in, because it would have to have something like Ion to come in to spark people to get ready for it so they don't get fooled by it. See, that's the relevance of Ion.
Say that again. What'd you say, Bob?
That proves I'm bringing in cold fusion, because Ion came as part of this program, and Ion's necessary to spark people so they don't get fooled by cold fusion because it's imposed on them. So you need like someone like Ion as part of the program of bringing cold fusion in consciously. You have to have something like that show up to surprise everybody and get them to a level where it's not even important whether it's cold fusion. Then it'll happen, and it won't be creation by default. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think the point was that if you become satisfied with your life as it is, then you can allow change to occur without it creating a disruption. But you have to first of all find your own satisfaction with the way you've already created or are already experiencing what you've created.
Right, and you can only get sparked. That's what Ion's here, is to spark people. If someone is not getting that, they need to be sparked by something, and that's what Ion's here to do, spark people, as many other things spark people. But Ion has a particular agenda of sparking people, so it gets them into the renewed sense of, hey, maybe I can do something with myself.
Yeah.
So these clients, when they get waves of euphoria, they think it's from the Ion reading, and it is, and they might think Ion injected in them, but they're going to have to realize, no, Ion just activated their own non-physical, and it had nothing to do with it in a way. But you needed the interaction with Ion to get activated. That's the paradox.
Yeah. I mean, when you start hearing about something new, maybe it's always been out there, but it hasn't been out there for you. And when you start hearing it, it means you're beginning to bring it into your experience.
Yeah. Like Ion celebrates all the people who hear cash flow because it came into their awareness.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, a trillion people don't know about it, but there's a big audience that are hearing it, and they're getting inspirited.
Yeah, and he admits that half of them don't know what you guys are talking about at all, but they get a buzz off it, and they get a curiosity, and they want to find out more.
Yeah, it's an environment. Like, people didn't know what television would be when it came in. There was all kinds of different projections about what it would do, but then it had all these effects, and half the people didn't even know them, but the effects eventually showed up and affected them. It's an invisible ground. Ion is an invisible ground. You look at its first interview in May 1st, 2009. They've been only been here for 6 weeks, and I think it's on Ray Allen's show. And somebody calls in the third hour and says, are you the return of Quetzalcoatl or something that the Mayans prophesied? And Ion goes, yes. Just, you know, blandly, yes. And then I might have said, so this is the second coming, and I added some other cultural dimensions, yes. So this, now, I've discussed a lot of this with Ion, you know, and I'd love for people to hear what I found out, but, you know, 1,000 hours.
Well, in terms of him being the ground, I mean, the television didn't really become the ground until it became pervasive and environmental.
Right.
But ION is, you know, we can only assume that hundreds of people might know about ION if they're tuning into the show, but that's so puny compared to an environment like the television.
Ah, but see, you think that it's just, we already got the National Security Agency listening, the Pope listens, everybody is tuned in, Putin listens. All this stuff is happening, and you have to understand, intelligence agencies find out things real fast because they are monitoring to look for any new ripple on the horizon.
You know, the one thing that causes me to feel what you're saying is incredulous, is how come I'm on the fucking phone talking to you right now? How could that possibly be? Because I myself am not that significant in terms of the game player on this planet. So what am I doing talking to you if this is all true? It doesn't add up.
I think about that all the time.
Yes, that was always the joke back in with Mike Dyer. People say, well, Bob, if you're running the world on this, why are you here? And I would explain why I was here. I've done that many times, but that's the incredulous part. Why would I be here? But that's McLuhan's point. Everybody's in the same spot. Everybody's in the singular membrane point. We're all in the same discarnate spot. So that means you're in touch with everybody, and you're going to include the elite. They're in the same room. And you can hear that debate with John Stadtmiller on the first cash flow. He couldn't believe it. He says, we're going to nail the Illuminati. But I said, you're talking to the Illuminati. I am the Illuminati. And it drove him up the wall. Eventually, he threatened my life right on the air.
I remember.
What happened to that guy?
He's the guy who created Alex Jones, and they broke up years ago, so he started his own network. His network's still going, Republic Broadcasting.
Huh.
So
he hated the Bob stuff.
Yeah, you heard some of it?
Oh, yeah, I listened to a lot of those. They're fascinating.
Yeah, listen to the May 28th show, the June 4th, and the June 11th, the last three shows.
I'm sure I heard the last one where, yeah, he basically was almost, I think he, like, walked off.
He walked off, yeah. And then we started getting all these calls, and then James realized that John was blocking all the calls because he was talking too much. Yeah, anyways, here's the point. The invisible environment shows up first as effects preceding the environment showing up. What I got from ION, and ION hints that, cosmic awareness, the evergreens, Abraham, Seth, and anybody else of that level were the effects of ION before ION showed up. And Bob is the common link through all of them. You see, that's where the environment shows up, before it shows up, okay?
You know, the odd thing for me, and this is just personal, I mean, I'll never get you to add it, put any significance on this, Bob, but for me, Lazarus was better than the Abrahams, the Evergreens. Well, I didn't have, even the Evergreens I had tapes of, he was better than course Ramtha and all of those, and yet he's never become part of your bev. You know, you've never addressed that with ION, and he's not part of what you claim to be are the best channels.
Yeah, I never met him. I never got involved with him. I only heard of him. I think he was promoted by Sherman McLean. My world never drew him into me.
Yeah, but see, there are apparently other rogue, non-phenomenal beings out there doing similar stuff to what ION's doing, although ION is, the quality of what ION's doing is different from Lazarus.
Yeah, because Lazarus is an entity. ION is not an entity. Look at the name. ION is a subatomic particle. It's part of our structure.
Oh,
that's why ION is an appropriate name. It's not an entity. It's part of our structure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I hadn't thought of that. I like that.
Yeah, and ION picked the name ION.
Oh, I thought you chose it for him.
No, we were calling him Ian.
Oh.
And then I got an email from JW the next day. This is just a few days into after March 18th. Are you still there?
Yeah, I just got back. Yeah.
So you hear this. So he says, I suggest, what about the name Ian? That's how I read it and I look at it. He's got ION. He's got a question mark after it. I said to Carolyn, JW spelled it wrong. I don't know. But then we said, well, what is this? Let's look up ION. So we looked it up and it fit because it was a mythical figure at the Oracle of Delphi raised by priestesses of mediumship at the Oracle of Delphi raised ION. So I thought, well, that's me and Carolyn. We've done this kind of stuff many times, so maybe we're raising ION. So we started to think, okay, maybe he means ION. 6 months later, I find out after Ion starts sending me emails, maybe it was about 4 months later, I go back and I said, shit, that email didn't come from JW, it came from Ion.
Oh, here's a point I want to make about that, Bob. You need to bring up one of those emails and click reply all and see who the sender was.
Okay. Well, it comes registered from JW's computer.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, yeah. So.
Yeah, and JW...
See, and initially I wanted to argue with you that JW is somehow doing this either consciously or unconsciously, but, you know, you're winning me over. Ion is quite capable of sending an email. He's quite capable of playing the piano. Have you heard, Scott, have you heard any Ion play piano on the Cash Flow show?
No.
Oh, he's tremendously talented pianist. Now he does choose his own songs. You challenged him, Bob, to play something, you know, crazy. You challenged him to play, you know, Thelonious Monk or some wild jazz improvisational thing. He didn't decline, but he didn't do it either.
Not right then.
Yeah.
But about this. So JW, I mean, I know JW. We've seen him do Ion. I haven't been in his. Well, no, we got together October 2008. Remember I announced that was a big important meeting in Kansas, Scott? That was my next time in person with JW, and that's 4 or 5 months before Ion showed up. But I haven't seen JW since Ion showed up, but I have seen him do Ion on Skype.
Uh-huh.
And he's sitting there, and his eyes get a little glazed over, that's all. Now, Ion, we did a reading last night, and... two-thirds into it, Ion said, somehow JW came up, and Ion said, well, JW's sound asleep. Sound asleep. And I said, what? Okay. That means one of his kids came by, and this is late at night, but when his kids walk into the living room or wherever he is, and he's lying there, they would see him lying there with his eyes closed and talking on the phone. And they say, oh, he just has his eyes closed. But if they realized he was asleep and talking in his sleep to us, and so that was a neat scene. So when JW called, woke up, we were talking, and then we mentioned, hey, you were asleep. She said, damn right, I was all curled up on the couch, had all these pillows around me. I was very, very peaceful. That's what he recalled, being asleep.
Yeah.
Okay, back to this thing. I'm saying I know JW pretty good. And I know a lot more about him because Ion has outed him many times, just like he outs me and Carolyn occasionally. So I got him a long time ago to check his email, and he says, no, there's no email in his sent file showing that it was sent to me. But every now and then, instantly, JW, over the last couple months, he'll go, hey, I got an email from Ion. Oh, which one was it? Yeah, we get them all the time, and he'd say what it was. And I said, yeah, we got that. But he says it, like, innocently, like he's delighted. It just comes out.
Yeah, I got one too, Bob.
Yeah, so it seems that Ion is doing it. And what Ion does, he sends me news stories. I mean,
initially when you talked about it, I got the impression that somehow he was changing the, and I think you believed it too, he was changing the electrons in the wire in order to manifest an email on your computer. I believe what he's doing is actually using JW's body to sit at the keyboard and type, just like he sits at the piano and plays. He's not electronically creating something out of nothing.
No. First of all, I'm always getting news stories from Ion. Fringe stories are just interesting stuff that he wants me to look into or to ask Ion about. JW does not spend much time on his computer. He does not watch the news. The news is not allowed in his house. He doesn't take in anything. He's not doing that.
No, I'm just saying if Ion can play piano, he can certainly sit down at a keyboard and type an email. He doesn't have to send you an email that would actually never was sent from his computer.
But JW, I've asked him about that. Do you think he's doing it? He says, well, if he is, I don't know it. Because...
Well, he doesn't know a lot of what Ion's doing if he's capable of falling asleep.
Yeah, when we put him in trance, he doesn't know. He doesn't know he played the piano. But if JW is walking around, he's got kids and family, he can't be unconscious all the time. He could be, but he's not doing that. He only goes into trance when we evoke him, when we set it up.
Yeah. So you think he's only doing Ion when he's talking to you?
Right. Now, it has, there's a whole other level of his interaction with reality that's confidential. In other words, I can't go any further with this. What I'm saying is not wrong, not a lie, but I can't tell you about what else is going on.
So what happens to Ion when JW dies?
Well, Ion is the non-physical. Ion is the water JW will swim in when he dies. Same water you'll swim in. Call it water.
But is someone else going to...
No, I don't think so. JW is not planning on dying. And that's the top secret stuff I can't go into. Eventually, as this goes on, we'll be able to talk about this with, you know...
You've been talking about it quite explicitly with respect to your own self and Carolyn.
I'm talking about the... There is living forever, but that's parallel to this other stuff that's going on.
That you can't talk about.
Yeah, it's... Yeah,
and why can't you talk about it? It's too early to reveal it. It would shake. It would cause an earthquake or something.
It's JW's life.
Oh, it's private. It's personal, private.
Yeah. It's
confidential.
He'll talk about it when. I mean, he will if he becomes more well known. People are going to want to know about him.
Yeah.
And he's going to be interviewed, and then we'll see what he says.
Yeah.
I don't know if he'll talk about what I'm talking about right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty. I'm posting on Five Bodies. This is the great event, the greatest event in human history. Okay, that's ridiculous, right? But people expect these kind of big things from me, so I'm the perfect guy to say them. But I'm telling you personally, from what I've experienced over the last 9 months, I have no problem saying that.
Yeah. Well.
But I understand.
You believe in the possibility and maybe even the probability of it, but will tell.
Yeah, I'm writing it for the record. I'm putting it, I said that on, you know, February 2nd. I posted on Five Body, whatever the date was recently. That's me not, I don't expect people to believe it or even care about it. A lot of our readings are being done for the record so that in a few years when people... when they can hear the readings, they'll say, wow, that was said then, and this happened, that happened, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's more we're talking to ourselves right now, and I don't have any problem with anybody hating us or not believing it, but no problem, but it ain't stopping us. And you know me, Scott, if something's stupid, I ain't doing it.
Yeah, and you're willing to look stupid doing stuff that's not stupid at all.
Yeah, that I know looks stupid now, but later is considered prophetic.
That's the thing, you know, when I saw Sarah Palin and they were revealing that whole thing about how she put her notes in the palm of her hand, and, you know, but she stands up for herself in spite of it, and I said, you know, she's the closest to Bob I've ever seen, but she's it's impossible to humiliate her. You know, and my friend said, well, they're not close in philosophy, and I said, no, but they're both totally Teflon.
Yeah, and there's it's not philosophy is not what it is.
Yeah, I know. I wouldn't have chosen those
no,
words.
No, it's not. It's a state of being.
Yeah.
It's going rogue. That's the name of her book. Bob has gone rogue and created Ion.
You know that there's a fake book out, Going Rouge, eh?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, actually. Some lefties, I think from Salon magazine or something. And actually, it's supposed to be a kind of a serious book, but I think the same day her book was released, they put out one called Going Rouge, and it also has a picture of her on the cover, and apparently, you know, a lot of people who bought it, her fans, wanted to return it right away. This is the book we wanted to buy. It's like a critical study. What the hell?
Yeah. No, there's a... the Palin phenomenon is the figure for a new ground, and the lefties and everybody else analyzes it erroneously.
I kind of think it would be quite sensational if she did become president, because she's so explicitly dumb. It really would blow the lid off of the whole president thing.
That's right. Yeah, the president ain't too important anymore.
Bob, you know what article I've always liked by you a lot is you did that article after the 2004 election.
Yeah, the WBAI article.
Yeah, I mean, I, I, I mean, I haven't read that in a number of years, but I'm always sort of referring to that article in my head when all this stuff with Palin and all that stuff comes up. It's like, it really does just seem so... I wish that article was out there.
Do you have it?
On the blogosphere and stuff, because that is just so good. It's like, holy shit, that's like... That really is sort of, in a nutshell, so much of what's going on. And like, why don't these guys kind of get that? It's like... It's odd.
Yeah, so it's an invisible environment. And maybe if you... I think that's on Five Bodied.
I think it is.
Way back there, but I need to put a sticky on that. I need to have that on the front page and always staying there. So if you've got it, can you send it to me or find
it?
Yeah,
I'll take a look.
Find a link.
I think initially, I think it was Dave who sent me a link to it. But I'll see if I can find it and let you know.
Copy me on that so I can have it too.
Yeah, you may have read it once, but yeah, I did that long after 2004.
Well, and then there was a fairly well-known piece, I think, about maybe 2 years later. Like, I'm thinking it was like sort of in the middle of the Bush's second term, and there was a profile in the New York Times magazine or something. I don't think it was of Bush, but of one of... It wasn't even one of the well-known guys. Like, it wasn't, you know, Cheney or Rumsfeld. It was someone else in his communications director or something. And he has an amazing quote, which is like, and I remember when I saw it, I thought, fuck, that is like, that's exactly what Bob is saying in that article to a T. And the guy's quote was actually quoted quite extensively, and, you know, people were up in arms about it. And it was basically something to the effect that, you know, we just use you guys as part of the, you know, our like what we sort of set the goalposts. It's tied in with the post information idea. I don't want to try and quote it right now. But I remember when I saw it, I thought, fuck, that is like, that encapsulates exactly what Bob was saying. And now you got all these people on the blogosphere like pulling their hair out reading this quote, thinking, you know, we live in an imperial with an imperial president and all this stuff. It's like, man, you got to read the like Bob put it into perspective, totally.
Yeah, so
we got to get that article out there.
And let's see if we can find that quote. I'll put
I think I have that quote bookmarked, actually. It's a really amazing quote.
Okay, good. And I'll put that quote in a new post on Five Body and then have my article underneath. I'll call it case closed.
Actually, I've got it bookmarked. I'll even send you now just a link to the article. The piece is called Faith, Certainty, and the Presidency of George W. Bush.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what the actual quote is that I was referring to. I mean, you may find other stuff in there, obviously, too, but it's a pretty amazing article, actually.
Good. Now, the point is, Scott, and you know this, the dialogue never ends. ION never ends. ION comes up every day. We're ready to play, Bob, you know, and they know it never gets done. The human thing is always incomplete. Communication is always incomplete. And if you know that, then you've got energy to do it forever.
Yeah, and you're the guy to do it. I can't imagine anybody really being able to engage ION for the marathon periods of time that you do, Bob.
Yeah, ION says, he's a critic. He said it, I think, the first time we were on Eben in May 2009. He said, Bob's the greatest asker of questions in the world. And that's true. And the other thing he says is Carol's the most compassionate person on the planet.
Wow.
I don't know. I wouldn't go around advertising that, but I know Carol. I know what she does.
Yeah.
And Ian's probably right.
Yeah, you know, Carolyn, the more I know about her, you know, I get her
blog or whatever, her newsletter.
Yeah, her health thing that you subscribe to, that I subscribe to, I get it every week. And I can't, her ability to take a thought and express it so beautifully and clearly and to knock these things out as if it's just water off a duck's back, I'm so impressed with her. And yet, you know, I remember the last time I saw her, in L.A., you know, she came up and gave me a big hug, like, you know, oh, I haven't seen you in so long, like I was the most important person in the world, and who am I? I mean, my God, it goes harks back to my other thing, why am I even talking to you guys? But
You're lucky. You're a highly evolved being, else you wouldn't be talking to us.
I guess so. I hope so. Anyway, Scott, did you see the, Earmap did a mocked up a Rolling Stone cover with Marshall McLuhan saying, "I am an intellectual thug," in an article by Bob Neverett. So, did you see that?
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
I'm going to send it to you once you and Bob get rolling, and I'll send it to you.
Should we do this, or I don't know. I mean,
okay, no, it's
I don't want to stay too late at this time. One of the first things I was going to say when I got on was, you know, I wouldn't mind being done this by about midnight. And now it's already 12:30.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be able to do it. You know, it's too late, right? I mean, you get wiped out.
It's a little late for me because I just find with, you know, we could try and impose some time on it, but I find with these exegesis, it's kind of really hard to. Put two, because I don't know. I find you kind of get going after we've been.
Yeah, and you can't do it for
30 minutes, 40 minutes kind of thing, and it's like to try and impose some. It's not like you and Ben where you kind of just chat.
That's right. And well, you can't get anything co-creating. Everybody's impressed with what you produce. I told you, Andrew Crystal said, you know, you bring out the good interviewer in Scott, and. That is not very hard to get that going with Ben, because he's not into co-creation, really. He's just.
Well, that was interesting, the thing that Ion said to Ben. You don't like to ask questions or something.
Yeah. The thing is that I don't mind doing what I do with Ben, but I'm glad that we have. This is what I told him last week. I said, Ben, if you want to know what I think about what you're doing, you got to listen to Scott's stuff. But he doesn't say, well, how do I get to it? He doesn't take that in.
Yeah.
And he heard one of it, and one of them, and he thought he knew what was happening, but no, he's not, so it doesn't matter. So the point is that what we're doing is good, and there's no rush. The world ain't waiting. Jim Patterson's waiting, but we don't need to. We could maybe do it next week, take a break, not wait 2 weeks, do it next week, and then take 2 weeks.
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah, we can do that. I mean, to me, it doesn't have to be a strict every 2 weeks rule, too. I mean, I was going through a really, really busy period around
Christmas.
You know, Christmas, New Year's time, and now that we're out of that, I mean, I've got some personal projects which I'm trying to sort of finish up, and once I've done that, especially, then, you know, we might even be able to go back weekly or whatever. But yeah, we could just play that by ear if we want to, you know, say let's do it next week, and then if we even want to do one. I was even thinking, I mean. There's still some times when I want to do a different type of show where, I mean, I want to go into, like, the Palin stuff and all that as well. I mean, because you don't really seem to be doing that anywhere else right now.
We
used to do it with Cash Flow, but
right.
Now it's
Ion. So, yeah, I don't mind doing that. And some people, you know, they email me, Bob, we want Bob, I don't want Ion, I want Bob.
Yeah.
But I said, well, you can just go to the Scott Woods interviews, you know, or Ben. And it's there. It's still there, and we can do that. And the other thing is, interacting with me is a comprehensive thing, and it requires what we're doing tonight, a whole, like, backstage or, what do you, offstage, talking about other stuff, because that's still the same topic to me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this conversation, I mean, I haven't contributed hardly anything at all to it. It's been a great conversation. I mean, it's, you know, it's...
That's what we're doing.
Like, it hasn't been a waste of an evening or something because we didn't tape a show.
Right.
It would have been nice if we did, and we'll make a point of doing it next week or whatever. But no, it's not. You know, the unfortunate thing is that it's not preserved. So if I was to talk to Dave or something, you know, he said, "How'd your chat with Bob go last night?" It's like, well, it was pretty cool, but you know, you won't be able to hear it, unfortunately. But
right. No,
but
that
it was, you know, very good. So.
Yeah, that what it is we do what we want to do. It doesn't have to be taped, and the whole point is to have, no, I wouldn't just say fun, but what we want to talk about, we talk about it. That's living in the present.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be fun, but if there isn't some element of play and fun
and
about
energy.
It, then I probably wouldn't stick around doing it, because
yeah.
What would be the point? I'm not getting paid to do this, so it's got to, you know... Got to get me off in some way.
Right. No, the old definition of school was leisure. Scalia was leisure. This is a leisure activity of co-thinking, co-creating, and getting pattern recognition. And I've got a lot of resources or topics to bring up. That's why I'm an endless asker of questions, Scott. I got, because I can remember a lot of things that I've heard or read or know, and I'll ask about all that. So it goes on forever. So it's an ongoing living process, and it includes this is a neat thing. you can't get to talk like others about other stuff with Meltzer or any of the people you interviewed. This is the extra thing about Dobbstown. We're actually, this is a side issue doing the Scott Woods thing. Scott has showed up at Dobbstown, so he gets massaged, and we get massaged by you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And that's the fun part of it. You know, that's the living part. That's the energetic part of it. That's what it's all about. Like, we never record another show. Doesn't matter as long as you keep showing up if you're energized to do it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing about tonight is that, you know, all kinds of details got revealed that possibly you haven't heard Bob say before, and some of these may enter your thoughts in the future when you are doing a more formal interview.
Absolutely, yeah.
And don't even call it formal. Just the you ask leading with questions, and you can bring up the ion stuff or bring up anything you ever heard that's associated with me.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we could, because the whole point is Sarah Palin is the Beatles of today, right now, for Americans. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, no, I agree.
That's its post. What was it? You guys were talking about the Grammy Awards, and you both were saying, I don't know if this was on tape the last time, about, you know, it was the circus.
Before we started taping, yeah.
Yeah, it was a circus, and I didn't know what had happened, but I saw something later, and some singer was whirling around on a rope.
Yeah.
Pink. Yeah, it's pink.
Yeah, and I said, oh, that's why they thought it was, I thought to myself, oh, that's why they thought it was a circus. But, yeah, that's what's happening. And that's why rock, Chris Gow, rock critics is dead. It's not rock in here. It's more than rock. And rock was always more than rock.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
I said this to you, Bob. I just mentioned it to Scott. Who was the woman in the Grammys who, you know, kind of stole the show, or she's the
Lady Gaga?
No. After her, super famous black woman,
Beyonce.
Yeah. Have you ever, Scott? Have you heard? You've heard Ion, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And have you ever heard him use the phrase? You know, human creators, blah blah blah, all day, every
right,
day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, Beyonce was being interviewed before the show, before the Grammys, on 60 Minutes, and they asked
That's
her.
Right. I saw a bit of that actually.
They asked her something about what she does that makes her so successful or vivacious or whatever, and she said something, and they said something back like questioning her, and she says, "Yeah, I do it all day, every day." And I thought, well, that, you know, could write that off as a coincidence, but maybe she's listening. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah, because that's the phrase Ion is used.
Ion has used that phrase. It's one of his stock and trade phrases. Because, yeah, I do it all day, every day. Well, I've never heard anybody say that before.
That's funny.
That's right. And Ion says now, Bob, when are we doing our 24-hour shows? I just want to keep going.
Well, J.W. probably wants to have a life to himself to some degree.
No, we had a reading today, which we just went over an hour, and then after the reading, J.W. comes into consciousness, and he gives the pictures he saw. He doesn't know why these pictures are, but he does it. So it ends up to be about an hour and a half total. But when J.W. came out, he says, 5 minutes? I said, no, it was over an hour. Jeez, it seems like 5 minutes. You when we do a 3-hour cash flow, J.W. comes out and he says, well, that wasn't bad. What was that? It feels like about an hour. He's like, so if he did 8 hours, it would just seem like 3 hours to him.
Wow.
You know, that's the way it is.
Yeah, but he's missing time from his own whatever productive life that he wants to lead for himself.
That's an understatement. You wouldn't believe what he's missing. Yeah, what else he's experiencing? And that's meant to be enigmatic, but J.W. loves to do this. It's every time he goes in trance, it's like a constant orgasm.
Mm.
Yeah, he loves doing it. And,
so he is conscious. He's not sitting. He's not just out gone.
Well, he's. I don't know what he is. He's sort of conscious. He's seeing pictures. Here's what J.W. experiences. This is the way it was from the very beginning. In his reality. He's in his home, in the room, and a box comes into his presence, okay? And he looks through the box and finds the file that answers the question that I've asked. And then as the reading goes on, the room fills up with boxes as many topics are happening. And he's always said, this is what he sees in his mind or whatever while he's unconscious. And he has to move from one room to the next because as the five-hour session goes on, all the boxes come in and he's going through them. And eventually he has to get out of the house in his mind. And he's out on the porch because the whole house is filled up with boxes in his mind, okay? Okay, so when we first started, off and I would go on and on and all over the place, and I would have to say, wait a minute, what's the pronoun? What's the verb of that paragraph? Where were we? Where are you going with this? It's just too much information or it's too verbal, not written out with proper grammar. And then when JW would wake up, he said, man, I was running all over the place. The boxes were just piling in. I couldn't keep up. And we figured out that when Ion is going on too much, JW is going through the boxes and finding files and releasing the files. And Ion is saying them. And that is why we have to sort of stop that or control it. That, you know, we have to sort of, it's like somehow JW has to not go through so many boxes so fast. But I don't know.
Is JW reading documents that he's pulling out of the? So that's interesting because I never associate the visual space element with the sort of channeled phenomena, but he's operating in visual space.
Yeah, he is seeing. Now, we don't know what he's actually, what's really going on, but it's like the human chemical body brain is interpreting non-physical speaking through him. Its brain system says, oh, there's a whole bunch of files, and Ion is scanning the files, and I've got to get the files to show Ion. That's not what's going on from Ion's point of view, but that's what JW's brain is experiencing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be funny at the beginning, because he said, man, I had to get, the boxes just piled up, and I had to go to the other room. Like, if anybody, someday they'll probably film them and watch them, and so they'll see JW lying there, or he's often walking around and doing things. I don't know if his body is miming going through boxes, you know what I mean? But he has baked cakes with his wife, he's done all kinds of things. But they might say, okay, there's JW. So, okay, we have a long reading, it's now an hour and a half. JW's now moved into the other room, and he's walking, pacing around that room, and he seems to be waving his arms and doing something. And then, you know, 2 hours later, he's now gone through three rooms. You know what I mean? If they were taping him, that's what his body might be doing.
Wow.
But it's all wow, man. I'm just telling you the surface shit. So then about 8 months into it, and last fall, JW said, and Ion told us. JW told us, and then Ion told us. But JW said, you know, I'm going to try and hear what's going on. I'm going to try to be conscious. I'm going to ask to be conscious during it. And so he would get glimmers of it. And then later, a month or two later, Ion said, well, as you know, JW said that he's trying to be conscious, and he's doing pretty good. He is hearing this. He is, like, not drowning in it. And so that's what he's going. He hasn't gotten there because as many times he doesn't know what we've talked about. I get incredible information, and I'll tell him about, I'll say, well, did you see the bit about this? And he go, what? He doesn't even believe what I fucking am talking about. He says, no. You say that happened? Yep.
So you know stuff, Ion's told you stuff that JW doesn't even know about.
Right. So it's a pretty interesting phenomenon.
Well, you know, it'd be pretty funny if JW asked you something and you said, "Well, I can't really go into that with you, JW." It's,
yes,
we're not ready to release that yet.
Actually, I have done that, Scott. That's been a joke. There's all kinds of joking between Caroline and JW after. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We've done that. As a matter of fact, we'd be talking about something and JW started giving us. I said, "JW, we don't want to hear from you. You go into trance. We only talk to Ion. You're out of this, buddy. We don't want to hear from you. You keep out of this." And I actually did that on a post today. I should read Frater's on this ongoing debate about what is Ion, is he channeling or not, and all that. I'll just read you quickly. So you got to go soon, right, Scott?
It's okay. They'll read the thing.
Right.
I'll cut out pretty soon, regardless if you guys are still talking. But I'll stick around for a little bit.
Okay, so that might be "Hello, Governor" is an interesting thread. Hello, Governor. Okay. I said, he thinks, Frater gets, it's crazy the states of mind he gets in. He starts saying, so now you're saying that when I say that JW is not a channel, a medium, and no spirits coming through, it's just the non-physical's coming through. He says, so now you're saying that JW is not a medium, it's just JW, you're getting rid of Ion. So I had to clarify. I said, I'm not saying Ion is just JW. I'm not saying Ion is just it's just JW we're talking to. I'm not saying that's what Ion is. I'm saying that JW is not a medium or channel. He's a large and allows Ion to speak. This is a new kind of phenomenon, and we can leave JW out of it. That's what I'm saying. Leave JW out of this. Because he's going on, Body Logic, who resents all this shit, we call him the leader of the un-Ionic conspiracy. He says, you're turning JW into a new god, and you're going to make the same mistake Christians make in all this. And if he knew how, we ain't going to see JW, not very much. You know, it's not about JW. We're not making, because Body Logic thinks Ion is just JW. They haven't got to the point. No, this ain't JW. JW is lucky to half gone. You know what I mean? This is something else that's coming through. And JW is not a robot. He's not losing anything. He's not feeling his life is less. He loves doing this. Plus some other stuff he got out of it.
So when the book is published and he gets public recognition, then he'll probably become a significant personality.
He's already told us which talk show person he will allow to interview him. There's many that won't, but there's one. He said, if that person requests an interview, I'll go on.
Mm-hmm. Oprah.
I don't think we've done lots of joking about Oprah. Sorry, Oprah. No, you come over to our show.
Yeah.
We're going over to your show. No, we've done a lot of talk about all that stuff. Because apparently it's going to be quite well known, this Ion thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
So Scott, have you revised any of your reservations about the Ion phenomena this evening?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I don't know. Like, my reservations were never really very well founded. Like, I mean, which I would admit, I've always kind of been assuming that there's a blank I'm drawing because I'm drawing a blank, not because there's something that's not interesting about the Ion show. And I was literally trying to ask Bob, like, why do you think I'm just not kind of getting it? Like, why isn't it clicking? And I've always kind of considered the failure at this point my own. So
you haven't heard enough.
But
have you heard every show? You should hear every show.
No, I haven't heard every show. Part of the problem with it being 3-hour shows.
It's hard
to find the time to do it. So.
So it's not that you're a skeptic per se.
The bit of it is skepticism, and probably more. I was more skeptical at first. I mean, I think I had a chat with Dave Neufeld about this when I went and visited him a few months ago, and even he seemed quite skeptical at the time. In fact, we were both sort of saying, you know, just sort of raising some of our own skeptical ideas about it, and he was surprisingly skeptical to me.
Right, and that's
actually
too much.
Kind of taken aback by it, but now he seems to be really into it. So
yeah, let me just give you a couple of his emails. I mean,
and Bob, since I've got, I don't think this would be too private or anything, but one thing that did drive me nuts, because I mean, this is something I've known. I mean, I hope it's okay that I mention this in Scott. I mean, it's not a big private thing, I don't think, but Dave Neufeld obviously was the asker of that one question.
Yeah.
About
the guy.
The, streetlights. No, the streetlights.
The streetlights?
Yeah, that was
a couple episodes ago.
The streetlights turning off.
No, I don't think that. Well, let me see. I've got Dave's.
Maybe I'm revealing something here I shouldn't be revealing.
No, that's all right.
That's a Dave Neufeld phenomenon. I mean, I've known that since I've known Dave practically. He's been telling me about that.
No, I've seen it happen.
I've driven in the car with him tons of times.
I just want to jump in.
I'm looking at it. I'll just read you Dave's letter.
Let me just interject. I've heard other people say that was true for them, so it's not unique to Dave.
Oh, okay. Then okay. Interesting. Okay.
But you know, Dave wrote a long letter, and all those questions. And the first time we went through them, Ion said yes, no, 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 yes, no. I don't know if you heard that, Scott.
Yeah.
Anyways, he did, and Dave got a bit pissed, and I said, Dave, those are big questions. We're going to come back to them. So a show or two later, we came back to them. We went through them in detail, and Ion was giving all the stuff. And then the phone went off, and so we didn't know it, and we kept doing it. And luckily, we taped it, so you can go on to How Ionic and hear the missing part addressing Dave's stuff. And then then we came back on, and the lights may have been addressed. I'm just going to find Dave's question here.
No, I think I think it didn't get addressed. I think like Ion said something like, "No, we've already talked about that. Let's move on."
I don't know,
but the thing went up, but the audience wasn't privy to it.
You mean it disconnected? Is that?
Yeah, like it was one of the moments where the show disconnected.
Yeah, and that's now all available. And I think either either he came back on and addressed it. Okay, here's Dave. Yeah, it was Dave. Here's his thing. How can someone offer up to cancel the guff? What aspect of the non-physical would be canceled? Why is this in any way necessary? Is this some rebellious no guff or enough with the guff movement that we've caused here in teenage heaven right here on Earth? Or are these issues precipitating from this realm Ion personified? How can the guff be crowded if there's no time? Is space still an issue? Does thought and experience occupy space? Does infinity still feel restrictive? What's happening in the guff that you want to swap it for something else? Is it really crowded? What's that like if that's the case? Who was the first soul and how and why did that come about? These are big questions, right? So the first time I read them through, and I goes, yes, yes, no, no, yes, no. And if you actually match up, they match. You know what I mean? You
could, right, right.
But I never did that, but I said, would they match? And he says, yeah. Now, we then came back to it a couple weeks ago, and I went, because someone else, we got into the guff, and then I said, well, it's time to do Dave's in detail. So we did it, and it was incredible, and then it turned out it wasn't, you guys didn't hear it, but we taped it, so it's up in the air, and we came back, and the very last two lines, I think we addressed this. Why do street lights often flash off when I approach in my car? Yeah. But I was saying that this email was from Dave. I didn't say Dave Newfield, but I said Dave. If you'd heard Dave.
No, that's right. Yeah. So all I wanted to know was what was the answer, but you're saying it's online somewhere I can hear?
Yeah, what I remember is we got to that point, and then we found out we weren't on the air, and then we got back on the air, and I think that got addressed or got lost, but we started to get into it. I remember saying it, and I don't know. You'd have to listen. I don't remember what happened.
Okay, I'll try and go back then, because, yeah, I was very curious. I mean, it's something I'm definitely interested in just hearing what Ion had to say about that. I mean,
yeah, like, I've never listened to any of the shows again. I mean, I have to do another session that night with Ion, you know? So
yeah, you've got to. It's just
I can't keep up with it.
It's endless for you.
What?
It's endless for you.
Yeah, and the... but I know I said the lights thing, and I don't recall much being said, and I don't know if we got back to it when we got back on the air, but we might have.
Okay.
I sort of recall trying to, knowing that if we didn't get to it, let's do it, but I don't know. So that's...
yeah, those are great questions, you know.
Yeah.
Six or seven of those questions I've pondered myself or wanted to put to Ion, but those are very articulately and nicely put. I like that.
Right, and Dave has done a new one, a whole bunch of questions on justice, but we haven't got to it yet.
But see, the funny thing is that, you know, if you know, Dave, on the one hand, appears to be wanting to write Ion off. On the other hand, he's putting that much energy into challenging him, he can't write him off. He's got to find out what's going on.
Right.
He's not just saying, oh, that's a bunch of shit, I'm going to walk away and not think about it.
No, see, that was 2 or 3 months ago when Scott visited him.
I think he's much more into it now.
Yeah, here it is, January 13th. He goes, hey, Bob, okay, the one, I know he sent a glowing one before the 13th, see if I can find it. This was like the breakthrough. This shocked him in a way. And this is the way it came through on the email. Dave says on January 3rd that December 31st show with Eben was fantastic. So good. That Afro-German preacher guy's interaction was incredible. Same with the reaction to the Patriot. Eben's a perfect host. That was like really coming around. So that's that. You probably went and saw him before Christmas, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so December 31st, on January 3rd, he hears the archive of Eben, not Cashflow. And he calls it a perfect show December 31st. And so I wrote back and said, that's interesting. I go, okay, that's interesting. JW asked about you yesterday. Maybe he was picking up on your enjoyment. Yeah, JW suddenly said, what's with that Dave guy? Like, JW has ESP sort of, too, you know, glimpses of it or something, or he'll think of something that comes up. So you know, he asked about Dave, and then later that day I got this email, perfect show, from Dave. So I say, that's interesting, JW asked about you. And he says, he writes back, lots of resonance and massaging, yes. Interesting things ahead. And he talks about what he's going to do, and we could talk. So then we're trying to hook up a call, and then he says, on January 6th, hey, what about these questions for the next cash flow? So then he says, here's another one, and he adds the streetlights thing, and that's January 6th. Then then 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later almost, January 22nd, he writes, Heard the three-hour show. Just fantastic. Osmosis. Something like that. Awesome, but osmosis, right? Awesome.
Yeah.
And then he says, careful with calling me the mastermind behind BSS, Broken Soul Scene. Best to call me producer, former member. And you know, I had said, this is a theme song from Broken Soul Scene, made by Dave Neufeld. I didn't even say Broken Soul Scene. Created by Dave Neufeld, because I want to give him way more credit than they're giving him. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And Dave, always careful, gets paranoid about it. Careful with calling me the mastermind. Best to call me producer, former member.
Yeah.
And then he goes, again, what a great show. It's a winner. Okay, so that's January 22nd. Then he says later, he sends a little note, I take it you dig Kevin's lyrics. Looking forward to the show. It's amazing what you guys are doing. That's January 26th. Then February 9th, so then we go into the present stuff. He says, oh yeah, now we go back to January 13th. Sort of gone into from December to February, but then on January 13th, he had written, hey Bob, great hearing you and Carol on Cashflow. Fairly good show, so this is after he loved the Eben show. I noticed you asked some of my questions on the air, but none were answered, and you guys pretty much instantly flipped to another topic. Maybe you can ask them on Evan's show, since they didn't seem to register on Cashflow. So I wrote back to him, don't worry, Dave, we're going to get their good questions, just that I just did it through and wanted to see what Ian would say. And we got it, but don't worry. So then he then writes on January 18th, I say something about the show, and he says, I love it. Music is Ion's favorite form of time. And I said that to Ion either on the show or personally, and Ion loved that statement and went on about it. So then on February 8th, he goes, listen to the show. Really cool, as always. That's great that you recorded the conversation that was absent from the broadcast. So he got to hear the missing part, right?
Okay.
He says, that was fun hearing you address the questions with Ion. The show the week before was really awesome. Really like hearing Ion speak with the callers on the show. And then he says, maybe we can talk later. So, you know, he just gets more and more enthusiastic.
Yeah.
So on that good note, Dave's, everybody's coming around. And Ion noticed, Scott. Ion says, a lot of people coming around, Bob. All those naysayers, they're they're getting the bug now. Oh, this is a huge, you don't know this guy. Guess who came around? Woo! Okay, if you get another 5 minutes, then you can go, Scott, right?
Yeah, a few minutes, and then I definitely got it.
Yeah, so George Renault is the big man with the Evergreens. You know about him, Scott?
I'm not sure about George Reynolds.
George Reynolds, the guy, the multimillionaire in Toronto who has listened to...
Yes, I know who you're referring to.
Yeah, and he digitized all my readings, so they're in my computer, and he gave me a lot of his. So it was a really good exchange because we asked both very different questions. And, you know, his son married a niece of Michael Blake Reed and Ellie, so he's an important person in the Evergreens world. Well... We've told him about Ion, and he went to the website. This is eight, 9 months ago. Well, it was May, June. He went there. He says, "What a crappy website! And who the hell are you talking to? Those little bites. Nothing's explained. He hated it. He didn't even understand what was going on." Okay. So, quickly find this. So the other day, we get an email from George, and amazingly, it's titled, Ion. It's just Ion. I go, whoa, what's this? He's acknowledging Ion? So here's what he does, and this is important, Scott, both Scott. He says, and this is on February 11th, just last Thursday, Bob and Carol, on June 13th, 1976, he says almost 34 years ago, which is 1976, the Evergreens gave eight phrases applicable to mankind today. And he gives the eight phrases, and these were always on the cassettes when you had a reading. And these are like the first affirmation stuff. I mean, Louise Hay and them did it in the 80s, but the Evergreens did it in 74, 75, 76. So here are the affirmations, eight of them. I am the result of me. I am more. I am never less. I discover newness about me each and every day. I act because inaction is decay. I speak because the words need to be said. I am the right person. I have no enemies. I have only friends I have yet to meet. I have no masters but myself. Now, that's all corny New Age stuff. That's spread all over the world the last 30 years. But Ion laid it out pretty well the first. So then George lays those out. Now he says, yet they also gave four more phrases. They said these were the future of mankind. And I don't recall these four phrases. I might have them somewhere, but they don't. I don't. They were not. They were more secret. These four phrases Evergreens gave were: I exist in an eternity, an eternity I can command. I exist now, in the past, and in the future. I have no boundaries, no limits, no ends. So he says the first eight were for humanity in 70s, 80s, today. But they gave four more for the future. So he says that. He spells that out, and then he goes, these are the ones that I believe Ion is illustrating / animating. He says Ion is doing the future. So then he says, I do not mean that the Evergreens in any way take any credit for anything. I mean the Evergreens were the best at that time and essentially illustrated what the future would bring. I presume that is Ion. Then he says, for whatever it's worth, you would not go amiss telling Evergreen fans that.
Wow.
Then he has in brackets, I've obviously come a long way in my opinion of Ion. So he's totally saying Ion is, the actualization of what the Evergreens predicted. So I wrote back to him. Now, here's the background. 2 weeks into Ion, you know, in April or so, March, April, out of the blue, Ion says, now, Bob, you have your association with Michael Blake Reed, and there's this person named George. I go, yeah. He says, George is going to be very important in spreading the word of Ion. And I said, oh, okay, that's interesting. He said, I suggest you tell him what's happening. So I didn't do it right away, and then by the 1st of June, we had the website up, so like 2 months later, I did what I was supposed to do, tell George about Ion. And the result wasn't too positive, right? So then and so I told Ion that, and Ion said, don't worry, George will be coming around. So then when about 6 months, well, 5 months later, like November or December, I sent a whole bunch of Ion YouTubes that Buzz had made, and he writes back and he says, you know, I must be old school. I never thought of marketing or a medium like this. This is incredible. He was very impressed with us going into YouTube and with Ion, right? So that was a bit of a crack. And then this shows up. And he's saying, okay, so I wrote back to him, and this will end it. I wrote back to him, and we. So I told JW and Carol this, and so we got together and we composed a letter because we fully were waiting for this announcement from George, so we wanted to figure out what to say to him. Because Iona said, George's got a big ego, and he's going to want to control this and all that aspect. So we wrote back, we agree with you, George. You know, we say, we agree with you, George. Ion seems to be what the Evergreens prescribe. And Ion has said many times that they are, quote, completing, unquote, the Evergreens' fine work. Your kind observation is greatly appreciated. George, you're the master of this genre of human activity, so your acknowledgement of Ion's work is very satisfying. You're welcome to inform the EG fans about Ion, so we give it the website. So what even, you do it, George. I don't have any list of EG fans or clients. He does, though. So we put it back to him, which is odd the way he said it. You should tell people, well, George, we don't know anybody. You do it. So we go, you're welcome to inform EG fans about Ion. We give the website, and then we say, and drop in for a session / reading someday. But he thinks he's quite enlightened, and he probably doesn't think he needs it. But that's incredible that he is given the nod to Ion. And he doesn't know Ion predicted it.
If Ion and the Evergreens are who they represent themselves to be, Ion must be more comprehensive, because when you talked with the Evergreens one time about, you know, you would call people that you wanted to talk to, yeah, who had crossed over, and they admitted that there were some people who would cross over and they would sort of see them zoom right by them and they wouldn't know where those people went.
Right.
Now Ion claims to be the ultimate place where people end up, so Ion would have to be more comprehensive than the Evergreens. If any of that's true.
No, I have discussed a little bit, maybe extensively, that very thing that you just said with Ion. We have talked a lot about what the Evergreen said. I've reviewed a lot of Evergreen stuff, Cosmic Awareness stuff, Worcester stuff, with Ion. We've sifted through it all.
And I remember when George, you relayed to me, asked the Evergreens if he could talk to the Evergreens. Do you have a boss? Yes. Can I talk to your boss? And then he had this
Evergreens too. We call them like we don't.
Yeah, but he had. But when he tapped into their vibration, it profoundly affected his consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, like a sledgehammer or something. But I guess you couldn't ask that of Ion, because Ion claims that there, I don't think Ion would claim he has a boss.
No, we discussed that very situation quite early. You see, what's surprising about Ion is that they knew all about the Evergreens and wanted to talk about it and how they were different from the Evergreens and all that. But we went into that George discovering EG2s, and we did a lot on that, but I can't go into all that.
But the Evergreens have not evolved into Ion. The Evergreens are still the Evergreens.
Yeah, the Ions, the Evergreens would be a subset of Ion. I mean,
yeah,
they're all non-physical, they're all valid, but Evergreens are entities. The Guff is all entities, Ion is all entities, plus more.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's lots more, but no, those are good points, and I'm aware of them, and I've discussed them with Ion.
Not surprising.
Yeah. So, anyways, a lot of things happening, Scott Wood.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, Norway, I looked it up. In Fringe, Scott, did I tell you this? And they're in the new episode, they're in the plane that survives, doesn't crash. Okay? Fringe? The plane that doesn't crash?
I haven't seen it. I don't know about
Woods.
Yeah,
the new season. The plane that doesn't crash, because it's another time loop, it's captained by Captain Norris.
Oh, yeah. He mentioned that in an email.
Yeah. So it's all intertwined. And Ion would win any Trivia Pursuit game. He knows everything about Hollywood, everybody.
Wow.
So that's why I said, why don't you do some Thelonious Monk? You know, we'll see if he can do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, guys, I got to go.
So, great session.
It's been great, yeah. And we'll email and make plans for the next one.
Right, let's try to next week.
Let's tentatively say next week.
Yeah, these are the melting titanium Scott Wood shows, the ones that nobody hears, because they don't get broadcast.
Okay.
Right. Talk to you later.
Talk to you guys soon. Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye, Scott.
I'll call you back, Scott.
Okay.